You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I got to beware. It's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, Political Crisis in the United States. Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
Delighted to be on the program.
Michelle, in your article that has just come out, Hillary Clinton, Wall Street's losing horse, constitutional crisis, what's the end game? You refer to the second letter sent by FBI Director James Comey to the U.S. Congress. What is the second letter as opposed to the first letter?
Well, this story is evolving by the minute. When I started investigating this over the weekend, I looked at the preamble to this event, and I think this is absolutely crucial. On the 24th of October, in other words, 4 days before the release of the second letter, there was a revelation in the Wall Street Journal, which I think is fundamental, pointing to bribery, fraud, and corruption within the FBI, triggered by a approximately 500,000 donation to the wife of a senior official in the FBI for her election campaign in Virginia. Now, this money was sent through the governor of Virginia. It was never acknowledged in the official records of donations for her campaign. From my point of view, it was a payout. But it was a payout not only to her, but to her husband, who is a senior member of the FBI. I'm talking about Dr. Jill McCabe, who was the candidate, and she is the wife of FBI official Andrew McCabe. Now, what happened is that Andrew McCabe, a few months after the election, which she lost, incidentally, she didn't get her seat, a few months later, in January of this year, 2016, Andrew McCabe was appointed deputy director of the FBI, in other words, number two man, and he was put in charge of the Clinton email investigation. How convenient. It's very similar to, you know, the mafia boss in the 1930s. We see it on Hollywood buying up the police, okay? You give them a bribe of $500,000, then you put them in charge of an investigation on organized crime, and their function essentially is to stall that investigation. Now, that works as long as the information is not made public regarding this corruption within the FBI. In other words, number two man Andrew McCabe is corrupt. There are pressures from within the FBI directed against the director, James Comey. And I assume that James Comey also wants to ensure his authority and quote unquote integrity. So ultimately, that is one of the elements. There are other complex elements with regarding the emails, but that's one of the elements which I think triggered James Comey's second letter. Because, for one thing, I don't think he wanted to be entirely complicit with this bribery of the $500,000, which was paid to his colleague, number two man, and so on and so forth. But what is very important is that Hillary gave $500,000 to a senior police officer in the FBI in exchange for favors regarding the Clinton investigation, which was not strictly limited to the emails. It was also pertaining to the Clinton Foundation and so on and so forth. There's a whole string of criminality behind the Clinton family. So that is the background. But I'll explain a little bit the second stage subsequently.
Michelle, hundreds of thousands of dollars were donated to Jill McCabe's campaign for state senate in Virginia, as you've just stated. She is the wife of Andrew McCabe, who was soon to be appointed FBI deputy director in charge of the Clinton email investigation, which you've just talked about. This huge donation was from, and this is according to the Wall Street Journal article that you cited of October 24th, this huge donation was from Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe. Now, who is Terry McAuliffe, and how do we know that this money was from Clinton? I'm assuming that these claims were made in the Wall Street Journal article.
Precisely. First of all, it was October 24th. Huh? The claims were made, in effect, in the Wall Street Journal, which used the term Clinton ally aided campaign of FBI official's wife. Okay, that was the headline. Group linked to Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe donated nearly $500,000 to 2015 state senate candidate. Now, that whatever they're supporting her election campaign. No, they're not, because she's married if the FBI official had stayed quiet at the lower ranks, but he didn't. He became number two man, and then he was entrusted with investigation into the Clinton wrongdoings. So he's obviously in conflict of interest. This is standard procedure in the police. We know it all we have to do is to go and look at a Hollywood movie. It happens in every second movie. You're buying out the police. But this is a different. This is not organized crime, as we categorize it. Buying out the police, bribing the police. It is a former Secretary of State and a candidate to the highest position in the land, namely President of the United States, which is bribing an official in the FBI. That is the crucial issue. Now, ironically, the media has not looked into it. They haven't followed up on that. They followed up on the email scandal, which is also, the email scandal is also pretty bad. It's the Huma Abedin emails, etc., have a whole dirty history behind that, okay, with pedophilia and so on. I don't want to get into that, but there are several authors which have examined it in detail. But the fact of the matter is that when James Comey decided to release this, I'm sure he knew everything beforehand, okay? And he may, whether he is a good, clean cop, a good cop or a bad cop, we can't establish that at this moment. But he certainly went against his colleague, Andrew McCabe, who was in charge of the investigation in launching this second letter. And the second letter is damning. It opens up a Pandora's box because there's not simply the emails. There's a lot of other stuff, very, very serious, including what I would describe as acts of treason. Why? Because Hillary Clinton's, well, the Clinton Foundation is funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, generous foundations, and it just so happens that Saudi Arabia and Qatar are financing the Islamic State, which is also, from the point of view of Hillary Clinton, is the enemy of the United States of America. They're waging a war on terrorism, and she was Secretary of State at the time. So, you know, that's an act of treason, okay? It's an act of treason to receive donations from the state sponsors of terrorism. But if we can get back to the chronology of what happened, I think it's very important. And then we have to ask ourselves, what is the role of WikiLeaks? I personally don't think that WikiLeaks are some hackers. The people behind WikiLeaks is the intelligence community. And I think that's pretty much known. They may be intelligence officials who are going against the stream, but there are very significant divisions within what we call the elites, the financial establishment, and there's also divisions within the media. And in effect, this trigger mechanism of the Wall Street Journal would not have happened if those divisions hadn't occurred. Because whereas Warner, you know, Times, Warner, CNN are just churning out smear after smear directed against Trump with very, very biased coverage of the election campaign, the Wall Street Journal, Fox News, and a couple of other media, they're not the majority by any means, they are, in fact, reporting on the misdemeanors of the Clinton campaign. And to address that, we have to understand that the man behind News Corp, which owns the Wall Street Journal and owns Fox News, is Rupert Murdoch, okay? The multi-billionaire, Australian of Australian origin, which controls a large share of the world's news media, not only in North America, but, I mean, worldwide. I can say, and I've looked into it carefully, Richard Murdoch is a strong supporter, or has become a strong supporter, of Donald Trump. They wined and dined in Scotland in the month of June. They've been meeting several times. And I suspect that this release by the Wall Street Journal, pointing to bribery and corruption at the highest ranks of the Federal Bureau of the FBI, that is something which was carefully timed to occur 11 days before the election. But it's not so much the that report ultimately, in effect, was a signal to James Comey. The issue of corruption is public. People in the FBI knew about it at all levels, and there was also pressure on the director to come clean, so to speak, and because his number two man, who was responsible for the for the investigation of Clinton and the emails and so on, Andrew McCabe, not only did he cash in on $500,000, at least his wife did, they didn't spend it on the election. I don't think so. I looked at the records of his wife's donation. First of all, they didn't declare it, which is illegal, okay? They didn't declare that money. So it was handed to them in some way. So that is the object of an investigation. But, of course, look, James Comey knew about all this before the Wall Street Journal came out. But what the Wall Street Journal article did is it brought to the public the fact that there was corruption and there was bribery, and that Hillary Clinton, in the same way as, you know, the mafia bosses, Al Capone et al., do, they buy up the police. And she did it through the governor of Virginia, who is a friend and a crony. That's what happened. And then we have to ask ourselves, who is behind this? And I think to say that it's simply Rupert Murdoch is a bit simplified. Certainly, he authorized this to take place. He had people writing in the Wall Street Journal, which on the whole have been critical of Hillary and her various and her record of criminality and so on, the Democratic National Committee and so on and so forth. But I think he understood very well that given the pressures that they had talked about, pressures within the FBI, it was really conflict between him and his number two man. And now his number two man is, he received the money, or, well, his wife, they must have a joint bank account. They received the money, but he's still sitting there. He hasn't been dismissed or investigated in any way. He's clean. He is clean. Why? Because he's being protected maybe by Attorney General Loretta Lynch, Clinton and so Clinton and even the Obama administration. So he's clean, okay? FBI Director James Comey is now threatened with legal action. They say that he broke the law. That's very far-fetched. And Andrew McCabe, who cashed in on the money, he's protected by the mafia boss. It's a very sort of typical, you could practically write a Hollywood script on this whole thing. Okay?
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Political Crisis in the United States. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, Michel, you have mentioned that the media in general is not really dealing with the information you've been describing that was published in the Wall Street Journal on October 24th. You've also pointed out that CNN, Time Warner, they are nonstop running ads or commentary against Trump. And then we have Fox, owned by Rupert Murdoch, Fox, Mail Online, etc. Also, maybe the New York Post also. The New York Post has printed a scathing remarks about Hillary Clinton. So there is this division that you've described within the media conglomerates, and then the people or the forces behind these two media conglomerates are obviously at loggerheads. Now, you have mentioned to me that the elites are not monolithic, that basically they all of them want to make money. How do you see the division here? I have always viewed Hillary Clinton's candidacy as the war candidate, basically. She's called for a no-fly zone over Syria. She has said that she wants Syrian President Assad deposed. She is making negative remarks about Putin nonstop, accusations about the Russians hacking her email, etc. To my mind, clearly, she would be the candidate that would continue the 9/11 wars. On the other hand, then you have Donald Trump, making statements in the debate like, "Well, why can't we get along with Russia?" Do you have an opinion as to what is going on here in terms of the conflicts among the powers that be behind these candidates? Now, obviously, there's the financial community, there's the military-industrial complex, there's the media conglomerates. How do you view this breakdown? Let's say, are the elites no longer supporting Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think it's pretty complex. I think that Hillary Clinton is really the proxy for, the proxy president. She's a puppet for what we describe as the neocons, okay? The neocons is a power elite. It's on Wall Street. It's the military-industrial complex. It's the oil companies. It also has a long-term military agenda, which was defined in the Project for the New American Century. It's continuity in relation to George W. Bush and of course, Obama. Mind you, that sort of neoconservative consensus is quite widespread because, Kerry also is in the same bag, okay? He's also calling for a no-fly zone and this, that, and other. So we're not... What we have is, I think, a clique, both in terms of foreign policy stance of maybe the think tanks, Council on Foreign Relations, Project for the New American Century, and so on and so forth, which now are pushing forward this notion of confrontation with Russia, including a World War III. Okay? They even say that. They have a new doctrine on nuclear weapons, which was formulated back in 2001, 2002, of preemptive nuclear war. They have actually cleared tactical nuclear weapons, the small mini-nukes, but which have an explosive capacity between one-third and 12 times a Hiroshima bomb, the so-called B-61-11 and the new version B-61-12, as harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground, quote-unquote, scientific opinion on contract to the Pentagon. And Hillary, in her campaign, it says, yes, nuclear weapons on the table. And with regard to Iran, she even says, and she quote, and I quote her, we will obliterate them, quote unquote. Now, I think, first of all, that perspective of hers, of actually igniting and having and believing somehow that they can win World War III, because World War III will not be won by anybody. It's terminal for humanity. And we've just published an article on nuclear winter. There are 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world, and Hillary wants to use them. Now, inevitably, within the establishment, there are interest groups. Some of them don't care. They just want to make money. But there's not much money to be made out of a terminal World War III scenario. So there is a lot of dissent within powerful interest groups against this agenda, including the armed forces. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, just a month ago, informed the Senate Armed Services Committee as well as Secretary of State John Kerry that a no-fly zone over Syria would lead to war with Russia and that he did not contemplate that as a wise decision. So there's a lot of dissent within the armed forces, and there's a dissent within the intelligence community. There are people in the legal profession. We're not talking about, the activists and the hackers. We're talking about people who have been running, who are career within the system. Now, there's a very interesting sideline to that, and I've just recently published it. It has to do with a former Undersecretary of State. His name is Steve Piezenik is a Polish name. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in several U.S. administrations, including Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush. And he has just recently released a video. He has a blog site, and he provides an analysis and focus, which I think should be taken very seriously. It sheds light on the fact that the political crisis in the U.S. And the opposition, which is developing from within, is from the intelligence community. And he is a former intelligence official. And what he's saying is essentially that the Clintons, but broadly speaking, is more than that. It's the entourage and the groups that support them, including the weapons producers, that Clinton is planning a coup, which is leading to the demise. Well, in effect, is leading to what I describe as the criminalization of the state apparatus, of the judicial system, okay, of law enforcement, because then you have an attorney general who is being threatened or bribed or whatever, and then you have a guy in the FBI at a very senior level who is being bought out with $500,000, and he has made a statement to that effect, and he's also intimated, of course, that WikiLeaks is really originates from U.S. intelligence. Okay, I've always believed that WikiLeaks, which sends us so much information, which has now become sort of authoritative, is from it's from within the system. It's not some activist hacking and getting hold of the emails. It must be a very organized process. So though we have to ask ourselves, who is behind WikiLeaks, which releases this email and reveals the criminality of senior officials in high office. I beg the question: who is behind FBI Director James Comey? I think that James Comey is ultimately responding to a situation of crisis, and he's trying to cover his ass, if I can use the expression. I think people do use that expression. There he has a number two man, Andrew McCabe, who essentially is Hillary's Trojan horse within the FBI, and who's taking instructions. At least he's conducting his investigation in a way which is not going to damage her. But then you have, you asked me, are the elites divided? Well, historically, they've always been divided. There's always been conflict, and those conflicts have led to wars. They've led to recessions, speculative onslaughts, manipulation inside the banks that are at each other's throats. And maybe they stick together, and then they go after the Italian banks. Okay, but there's constantly a conflict and division within the establishment. Now, what was revealing last night, I started sort of switching back and forth between CNN on the one hand and Fox News on the other. The discourse was so incredibly different. And then Fox News, the Hannity show, which is not my favorite show by any means, okay, they once invited me, and I turned them down because I thought they were going to, well, they did intend actually to smear me, but actually Hannity was really good. He interviewed Giuliani, and Giuliani, former mayor of New York, comes out, and he doesn't necessarily say I'm in favor of Trump. He says Hillary Clinton is involved in a criminal undertaking, which nobody can support, okay? And I mean, she was senator for the state of New York, and he was mayor of New York. They know each other. Maybe they hate each other, but the thing is that you have prominent people who are now, they're not necessarily siding with Trump. They're siding against Clinton, you see? Well, they may be siding with Trump. Trump, from my standpoint, well, I'm in Canada, so I'm not going to vote, unless, of course, the United States decides to annex Canada. But Trump is not a dangerous candidate from the foreign policy perspective, because at least his narrative, what he will do, that's another matter, but his narrative is not saying we must go and kill Assad and wage war on Russia and move our troops to the Russian border and start bombing them with nuclear weapons. That's what Hillary Clinton is intimating. So that, in effect, I think that Trump, despite all his personal features and so on, is, they're not comparable, but he's not as dangerous as Clinton. Clinton could unleash World War III. And one has to address how a World War III is actually decided upon, apart from the fact that sometimes it's error, misjudgment, paranoia, whatever. But it's pressing on a button. And the pressing on a button to wage, let's say, a nuclear attack doesn't necessarily come from one person. It's the result of consultations with advisors, the military, this, that, and other, debate, discussion, do we do it, don't we do it? But ultimately, the President of the United States can say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to press the button and initiate a third world conflict. And she will not hesitate one moment. And if she had to make that decision, she'll make it. So I've looked at all her statements. She's a very dangerous person.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Political Crisis in the United States. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Michel, you have said to me that whoever ascends to the presidency of the United States, that whoever the next president is, the presidency will be a dysfunctional one. Could you describe how the new president or the new presidency of the United States is going to be dysfunctional? In what ways? What could happen, whether it's Clinton or Trump? And then I'm wondering, how dangerous is a dysfunctional presidency? Is it safer, like maybe things won't get done? Or would it lead to maybe a leap forward into war? What about why do you say that the next presidency will be a dysfunctional one?
Okay. Well, first of all, if Hillary is elected, let's assume she's elected, Hillary's criminal record, which is there, and the investigation is ongoing, and it is very extensive. It's not just emails. It's the foundation. It's targeted assassinations. It goes back to her days in Arkansas. Her criminal record will haunt her throughout her term in office. I have absolutely no doubt about that, leading to the possibility of an impeachment. But even if it's not an impeachment, the public will know about it, okay? The public will know about it. I once said to myself, well, you really need a criminal record to get to be appointed as candidate to the United States presidency, okay? You need to be, because criminals are people you can manipulate, so they're good puppets. But I think that in the case of Hillary Clinton, her her record is so extensive that it will be very difficult to hide. So there's that element. It will haunt her throughout her presidency. But inevitably, Trump will launch a procedure claiming fraud, because I think there's going to be fraud. Okay, we've done a fair amount of research on the voting machines and so on, and there was fraud in previous elections. But in this particular case, you have a person, whether we like him or not, he has a certain element of grassroots support. And if Hillary wins the election by a small margin, we can be sure that he will launch a procedure against her and against the vote and so on and so forth. So we're dealing with two. If we periodize what's going to happen, we've got three periods. We've got from now, November 2nd to November 8th, okay, when the results come in. That doesn't leave much time. But things can happen within those 6 days in terms of more information coming out, which will influence the voters either way. Okay. Secondly, we have the period between the 8th of November the aftermath of the election until the transfer of the position of presidency, which is in the month of January. Okay, so it's about a month. Lots of things can happen within that period, particularly in relation to irregularities. And of course, the criminal record of Hillary Clinton is still there. People across the United States, and there was a poll just conducted a few days ago, people don't believe the media anymore. The recent poll believes that 75% of people participating in this sample, in this sample poll, they believe that the media is lying to them when they say that when Russia is intervening in the elections or in the Democratic National Committee and so on and so forth. They don't buy that anymore. They know that the media is lying to them. And I think that we're in a situation where mass protests could very well unfold. But let's say if Hillary comes in, Trump will launch one or more procedures pertaining to fraud at different stages of the election campaign, voting machines, etc., criminality. The FBI will continue, okay, with investigation. Those records are there. They can't be wiped out. I'm sure that immediately after the election, if she is elected, Trump will renew his campaign against her on corruption, large scale, et cetera, and attempt to block any kind of her accession to the White House. Now, she's dysfunctional, but so is Trump dysfunctional. So if Trump is elected president, there will also be attempts to unseat him, right? Calling for his impeachment. The other side is going to do it because they're very powerful. They've got the nail cards behind them and so on. They're going to do something to destabilize Trump. And it may be actually what I'd call Plan B or Plan C, which posits that if both candidates are dysfunctional, we might be moving, not necessarily immediately after the elections, but at some point in the future, we might be moving towards a situation of martial law. Okay, it's not an impossibility. Okay, the unfolding political impasse, coupled with rising geopolitical tensions in Syria, Iraq, Eastern Europe, on Russia's border, the possibility of a World War III, it could potentially lead at some future date to the suspension of constitutional government under what is described as the... There are many pieces of legislation to choose from, but the most significant and the one which is least known by the American public, because the media have simply not discussed it and debated, is the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, H.R. 1540, which was signed into law by President Obama on December 31, 2011. And then but there are other pieces of legislation which have been adopted both before and after 9/11, which allow for this transition to police state America, namely the repeal of civil liberties, the surveillance state, the militarization of law enforcement, and so on. And that, of course, that is also geared towards the broader public, who might protest to having Hillary Clinton as president of the United States. I certainly would protest. And also the fact that these rising political and social tensions are the result of years and years of austerity measures, closing down of jobs, offshoring, and so on and so forth, mass poverty in throughout the land, this eventually will, I think, backlash. It's the consequence of a macroeconomic agenda, the so-called, not the neocon, but the neoliberal macroeconomic agenda, which has devastated national economies since the 1980s, but which is also now applied in the United States of America and in Western Europe, and we saw what happened in Greece. So, you know, if you look at dysfunctional presidencies, you might say, well, maybe there might be a transition towards martial law in the forecoming years. Not, I wouldn't say necessarily immediately after the elections, but that is how it's likely to unfold. It's very difficult to predict what will be the result of this election.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Political Crisis in the United States. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Michel, you have been describing a political crisis, and you've touched on an economic crisis here in the United States. It sounds like some sort of perfect storm is brewing on the political front, the economic front, the geopolitical front. Vladimir Putin is preparing the Russian citizens for nuclear war. They're moving armaments, of course, into Syria. There was also, I read, he had a drill in Moscow where the millions of residents of Moscow could go underground. Putin is taking all of this war talk from the neocons and from Hillary quite seriously. And I think hopefully now people here are not thinking it's a big joke anymore. It looks like there's a perfect storm brewing, and kind of hard to say what is going to happen, right?
Well, there's no doubt the storm is brewing, and I think we're at a very dangerous crossroads in our history, and this is most probably the most serious crisis in world history, because it could lead to the end of humanity if and when a nuclear war is instigated, and I think even the vote at the UN last week was very significant. That there's a consensus that nuclear weapons have to be banned, have to be eliminated. But that's not going to happen, and it's not going to happen within the immediate short term. Now, with regard to Russia, those emergency measures, the scenario of emergency measures, was not strictly in Moscow. It was across the Russian Federation and involved something of the order of 40 million people. In other words, these were areas of underground refuge areas. I guess in Moscow it might be even in the subway system. I didn't follow the details, but it was 40 million people. Now, I mean, when you do that, it sends perceptions both to those who are planning to attack you. It also sends perceptions to the Russian people, okay, that this is serious. But at the same time, you know, there's a sort of a little bit of a game going on between the two sides. Russia is threatened by the United States with nuclear weapons. It doesn't mean necessarily that they'll do it. I don't think they'll choose Russia initially. If they're going to use nuclear weapons, it might be against Iran. Okay, and the statements have been very strong. But that will unleash a broader war inevitably. Okay, but I think that first of all, U.S. policymakers now have become increasingly aware of the fact that Russia has a very advanced military arsenal, which at the end of the Cold War they didn't have, okay? Because there was a period with Yeltsin where they were actually dismantling it. And but that is not the case today. Russia has a very advanced military arsenal. It's controlled by the state, which gives them much more leeway in making it functional rather than money-making or profit-driven, which is the case of the big defense contractors. It doesn't cost them nearly as much as it costs the United States of America, so they can still allocate money to social programs and so on and so forth. But yes, we are. That kind of scenario is there. And you mentioned recently, of course, they're moving an aircraft carrier to the Middle East. It's the Kuznetsov, okay? It's the Russia's Kuznetsov. They don't have many aircraft carriers, but they moved it to the Middle East and immediately, and they have a naval base there. So there's nothing really particularly. It's routine. They're moving warships to the Middle East, okay? And they're also saying, well, listen, okay, go ahead with the no-fly zone. We have our planes are there, and they can fly them in from the Caspian Sea. The distances are not very large for a jet fighter. But the thing is that when they brought in their warships into the Mediterranean, immediately NATO meets and starts deploying weapons and tanks and artillery and forces at Russia's doorstep in the Baltic states and in Poland and Romania and so on. So you can see that U.S. NATO is on a war footing. They had the last when was it? Month of June they had. They had these major war games, which I think were very large. It was the Anaconda, yeah. Well, if anybody knows what the Anaconda is, it's a very dangerous snake. You know, it's symbolic. It kills people.
Well, yes, Michel, you and I did a whole hour-long show on the Anaconda war games that were taking place I guess in Eastern Europe on behalf of the United States. That's right. We called that show Global Warfare or something to that effect. Now, Michel, With regard to the scandals going on domestically here, with regard to Hillary Clinton, this whole email thing, Obama came out and sort of put the kibosh on talk about FBI Director James Comey having broken the law. I guess the Hillary camp was accusing the FBI director of having broken the law, and as you said to me, well, you know, Obama wasn't ready to back that up. One thing that has always I have not understood about this email scandal of Hillary Clinton's, what I don't understand about it is that the National Security Agency and the intelligence agencies, etc., would have known all along about her email setup. So if her email behavior was such a threat to so-called national security, then why was she allowed to do all of this?
Well, yeah, they've probably known a long time what she was doing. And there was probably very, well, I would say that within the FBI, there was people who were probably intent on protecting her, and then there may be people who weren't. But the thing is, it's not strictly, I don't think that it is strictly the emails, okay? It's much broader than that, and it has to do also with her foundation, okay? She's involved in money laundering. It's crony because the people who come make a donation to the Clinton Foundation, then they get favors when she was Secretary of State. It's not strictly one level of criminality. It's much, much more, you know, it's much more serious. We have to really reflect on that. Now, you said that that Obama didn't take such an active stance with regard to the illegality. Was it with regard to the illegality of James Comey or what?
Well, James Comey was being accused by the Hillary camp of having broken the law, coming out 11 days before the election and saying that the FBI was reopening the investigation into her emails.
Well, I mean, the thing is that James Comey did the right thing, because what she had done, as reported by the Wall Street Journal, but also in relation to the email scandals, reveals a whole network of criminality and corruption. I think he did the right thing. Now, they're accusing him of having brought this information out prior to the election, but in fact he didn't, because it's already been brought out on several occasions. There was a first letter, but there was a whole discussion of these issues going months and months back. So this is nothing new. But what is new is the fact that the corruption within the FBI is now known to everybody, at least to people who read the Wall Street Journal, because the media is not talking about it. Okay, but the thing is that there you have a guy at the upper echelons of the FBI, his number two man, Andrew McCabe, who is being bribed by the crime boss. I can use those terms. That's the mechanism. You bribe a senior police officer, so that you can continue with your criminality. And you put him in charge of the investigation, and he blocks the investigation. Now, I think Comey will go down in history. He will go down in history. And bear in mind, James Comey is appointed for 10 years. First of all, he was appointed by Obama, okay, 3 years ago. That's very important. Obama appointed him. And then he was, he reports to the Attorney General, and he also reports to the Director of National Intelligence, okay? Of course, his appointment is also approved by the Senate. But the thing is, you don't simply flush an FBI director, okay? I mean, in America, people remember the J. Edgar Hoover, you know, saga. You know, these people stay there for a long, long time. You don't move them. The deputy, and that's what amazes me. Well, it doesn't amaze me, but the guy who actually took the bribe of $500,000 through his wife is sitting there, and he's the hero. They're praising him, and they're still talking to him. And when, in fact, he should have been arrested for taking a bribe, it's open, at least investigated, and suspended, and he's not. But what they want to do, they want to get rid of Comey. But I think that's not going to be easy. Under constitutional government, that's not going to be easy to get rid of Comey. And I think that Obama, I don't think that Obama wants to be overtly involved in this scam in any way possible. He's supporting Hillary because she's a Democrat and she's coming after him. I don't think we know that Hillary ran against him, previously. And then she was appointed Secretary of State. He didn't want her as Secretary of State. They imposed Hillary Clinton on him. So there's a whole very complex relations which are unfolding. When I said earlier, I guess we're running out of time, but when I said earlier that there were conflicts within, let's say, within the economic establishment, it's not because Rupert Murdoch actually sides with Trump. Rupert Murdoch is all over the place. It's a media conglomerate which has alliances with the energy companies, with various sectors of the economy.
Well, Michelle, we are out of time. I'd like to thank you, Michelle Chosadovsky. Thank you so much for this great live interview on Guns and Butter.
Thank you very much. I regret that we're out of time. Best wishes. And to everybody in California and in the United States, think twice. Think carefully when you vote.
Thank you, Michelle. And Michelle Chosadovsky's website is globalresearch.ca. You can send me, Bonnie Faulkner, an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. This has been Guns and Butter. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Phyllis Bennis returns with more shrewd and sane insights about ending the many wars in Syria. I hope you'll stay tuned. Progressive author and activist Phyllis Bennis was in New England, October 13, 2016. She spoke at Emmanuel College in Boston. She spoke on her area of greatest expertise and greatest concern, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Her talk was titled, Ending the Many Wars in Syria, and we heard the first half of it last week. Last week, she focused on the complexity of the Syrian conflict. There's not a war in Syria, she says. There are at least a half dozen wars in Syria, half of them proxy wars. That is, wars actually between other countries, but being fought to the last Syrian. This week, Bennis continues. She refutes some of the myths Americans believe about the Syrian wars. The myth that the U.S. is not yet one of the belligerents in this conflict. The myth that our government is united in its opposition to Syria's President Assad. The myth that, under Assad, Syria's policies have been anti-American and anti-Israel. Quite the contrary. And she refutes the myth that imposing a no-fly zone is an alternative to war. In fact, it is an escalation of war. Then Bennis shifts gears and explores the staggering financial cost of America's undeclared war in Syria. Then she moves on to four good moves the United States government could make in Syria. Each of the four is likely to produce a better result than war. None of them is very likely to happen, though, especially not in an election year. That's Bennis's talk in a nutshell. But don't settle for the shell. Let's savor the rich stuff inside. Bennis is a fine speaker, a good scholar of Middle Eastern history, and seemingly a good person. I think it was Quintilian who defined the art of rhetoric as a good man speaking well. Except for the man part, that sounds much like Phyllis Bennis. Here she is again.
Now, there's a lot of mythology about the Syrian war. One is that the problem in Syria is that the U.S. isn't doing anything. The U.S. isn't intervening, and we need U.S. intervention. Well, it's a myth on a couple of fronts. Number one, the U.S. is right in there. The U.S. is bombing in eastern Syria. It's not bombing in Aleppo right now, which is very good because it would just be killing more people than the Russians and the Syrians are killing, and that's plenty. It's way too many already. But they are bombing, supposedly, against ISIS in eastern Syria. Now, the problem is what that means is, you know, you can't bomb terrorism. You can bomb people. You can bomb cities. Sometimes you can even bomb terrorists if you get lucky. But you can't bomb terrorism. And where ISIS is, there are people living there. They are living in cities. And the people in those cities have no ability to get out. So when we hear, and we hear this a lot about, we're getting ready for the attack on Mosul, we're getting ready for the attack on Raqqa. Those are the two kind of capitals of ISIS, Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq. Mosul is a city that once held about 2 million people. It now has, we think, somewhere around 675,000 people that are left. They can't get out. They can't get out. So when the U.S. starts to, quote, liberate Mosul with its bombers, ISIL will be able to get out. The people who live there will not. And that's who the people will be who will die. ISIS, I'm guessing, are going to get out and they're going to scatter and we're going to be hearing from them for a very long time. The same in Raqqa inside of Syria. So one of the myths is the U.S. isn't doing anything or it's not doing enough. Where people mean militarily. The U.S. isn't doing a lot of stuff it needs to do. But the military problem is not that it's doing not enough. It's that it's doing too much of the wrong things. So that's one of the myths. There's another myth that says that everybody in the U.S. wants to, in U.S. government wants to overthrow the regime in Syria. That's a myth also. There are plenty of people in power in Washington and some who are out of power, the neoconservatives and others, who have long wanted to get rid of the regime in Syria. It's one of the seven countries that were on the famous list that surfaced in 2002 that the neocons had been distributing about the seven countries they want to overthrow. That's certainly true. The myth is that that's the only reason that there's anything bad going on in Syria. You hear this from some. Not taking into account that Syrians themselves rose up against a pretty terrible government and tried to change it. The other problem with that analysis is that it doesn't take into account the reality of what the government in Syria has been about. There, one of the other myths is that the government in Syria, the Assad family, father and son, who have been in power since 1970, that they represent some kind of a center of resistance, an arc of resistance in the Middle East, that they are against the West, they're against Israel, they support the Palestinians, they're the real upholders of Arab nationalism. Well, it turns out, when you look at the history, not so much. It doesn't work that way so much. So you can start in from the time of the 1967, even before the Assad came to power, but certainly from then, Israel is occupying the Syrian Golan Heights, right? And the Syrian governments have made sure that the population was relatively quiescent, that the border stayed relatively quiet. Once in a while, there'd be a bit of a border skirmish, but those border skirmishes never resulted in full-scale war. Fast forward to 1976, the Syrian regime, in support of a right-wing Israeli-backed militia in Lebanon, launch a massive attack against the Palestinian refugee camp at Tel Azatar, killing a huge number of Palestinians. So this notion that they're all in the interest of Israel, against Israel and supporting the Palestinians kind of falls by the wayside. 1990, the U.S. is running around, President Bush the first, trying to get support for the first attack on Iraq, right, Operation Desert Storm. They want a coalition that includes Arabs to give them credibility. So they go to Damascus and say, will you join our coalition? And the answer is, sure, no problem. So Syrian jets, Syrian Air Force fighter jets, fighter bombers are sent to participate in the U.S. coalition bombing Iraq in 1991. 2003, in the global war on terror, the U.S. goes to Syria and says, can we outsource interrogation to you for detainees that we're picking up in the global war on terror? You're so good at interrogation. And the Syrians say, sure, why not? So one of those people is the Canadian citizen Maher Arar, who's arrested at Kennedy Airport, interrogated for 3 weeks by U.S. and Canadian officials. They think he's a terrorist. He can't confess to anything because, what a surprise, he doesn't have anything to confess to. But instead of sending him home, they ship him off to Syria, where he is held for almost a year in a dungeon, a coffin-sized dungeon, and tortured for almost a year. The Syrians can't get him to confess to anything because, what a surprise, he's got nothing to confess to. He's finally sent back to Canada. The Canadians launch a big investigation to figure out maybe they did something wrong, and they determine, as a matter of fact, we did do something wrong. We identified the wrong person. He is absolutely exonerated. He is guilty of nothing. He is innocent, and they gave him $10 million in compensation for what he had suffered. The U.S. response, to this day, he is still on the no-entry list for the United States. My institute gave him one of our human rights awards, along with his lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights, back in 2006. And he couldn't come to Washington to accept the award. He had to do it by video because he's not allowed into the United States. That's the kinds of failures that are endemic to this so-called global war on terror. So what we're looking at now is a series of failures all around the region. Calls to replicate some of those same failures. We're now hearing an escalating call for a no-fly zone in Syria. I always want to ask Secretary Clinton when she talks about it at the debates, so do you think that Secretary Gates was wrong when he said the first thing you have to do is go to war? Or are you saying you're fine with going to war explicitly against Syria and now that means against Russia? Are you being really reckless, or do you really think he was wrong about this? You know, the problem is, there's another myth, that a no-fly zone sounds great. We need a no-fly zone where nobody is flying and nobody is dropping bombs. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about one side imposing a no-fly zone on the other and imposing it by bombing the planes or whatever that try to take off, who knows what. So it's a huge problem. It's not going to work. It's going to make everything worse. But it sounds like something you do by declaration. You know, you do it instead of bombing. Yay, a no-fly zone. Except that's not the military reality on the ground. So that's what we're facing. Now, I want to just talk about two more quick things and then open it up for discussion and whatever. The first is about the question of the domestic cost. You know, this is not only about how these things come back in what the CIA calls blowback, when an operation ends up biting you. You know, you get the consequences of it. One of the consequences of our global war on terror is that the U.S. is resented and hated in countries around the world for our bombing and killing people in those countries, for overthrowing governments that may have been very unpopular, but that local people don't necessarily think we should have had the right to overthrow, for all kinds of things. But there's also a very immediate economic cost. The current global war on terror, what President Obama calls the overseas contingency operation, is not nearly as expensive as the Iraq war under George Bush. That's true. We don't have 150,000 troops and another 100,000 U.S. contractors operating in Iraq, occupying the whole country. We have special forces. We have bombers. We have drones. We have all kinds of things. We don't have that. So the cost is not quite as much. But it's not chump change either. So when you think about this war that was started in 2014 against ISIS, that budget is kept completely separate from the Pentagon budget. You know, the Pentagon budget is its own thing. So the budget just for the war, just here in Massachusetts from 2014, you all, you taxpayers here, are paying $19,956 an hour. An hour, 24/7, for just that war against ISIS. And you've been paying it since August of 2014. That's a lot of money. Now, if you look at the Pentagon budget, the budget that doesn't include the war, doesn't include the nuclear weapons, they're in the Energy Department, doesn't include caring for veterans, only includes kind of keeping on the lights at the Pentagon, you know, keeping them in their bases around the world. Massachusetts taxpayers just this year are paying over $17 billion for that budget, for the Pentagon budget. Now, a billion, you know, you could say a gazillion and it would mean the same thing. I don't think anybody – are any of you math majors? No, okay. I'm not even sure if you were a math major you would know, but I certainly never really understood what, you know, what a billion is or even a million. I will tell you one story. When I was, I think, in second or third grade, I had a teacher who came in one day with this giant piece of graph paper. You know, the kind with the really tiny squares that are like 10 to the inch. And she put it up on the board, and it went like through the whole blackboard. And she said, all right, you kids, I want you to look at this, because all your life you're going to grow up hearing about a million this and a million that, and you're never going to have seen a million anything. So here you are. This is a million little squares. Look at it and remember that's how many there are. And there were a ton of them. And that was a million, not a billion. We're talking billions here. So imagine. But even my little square analogy doesn't really say what it is. So here's a couple of trade-offs. If you were not spending that money on the Pentagon, here's what you could do with that same $17 billion. You could pay for 171,450 elementary school teachers for a year. You could provide 231,333 clean energy jobs. What would that do to the unemployment rate here in Massachusetts? You could get 1.6 million kids into Head Start, or you could provide health care to 4.6 million children. Now, you don't have to worry about kids having health care because you live in a state that actually provides health care. What a concept. Maybe I should move here. But in general, you get the idea of what that money could be used for. What's going to keep us safer? Jobs and health and education, or more money for the Pentagon? You know, this is a huge problem. So the last thing I want to say, and then we'll open it up, is about what we can do instead. You know, it's fine to say the military stuff doesn't work. What do we do instead? So there's a few answers. None of them are easy. None of them are guaranteed to work right away. None of them will work in the short term. We know that. We also know that the military stuff doesn't work in the short term. So we have to keep that in mind. And only one of the four has any chance of being implemented in the near term. Having said that, I will tell you what the four things are. There's more, but this is a start. Number one, start with what every medical student learns on her first day of medical school, the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. You know, they're taught when you have a patient, whatever else you do, don't make them sicker. If your goal is to stop ISIS or the Assad regime or Russia or whoever from killing people in Syria, stop killing people in Syria yourself. Pull out the troops, pull out the special forces, ground the bombers, bring them home, stop the military stuff. It's not doing anybody any good. It's making things worse and not better. You claim there's no boots on the ground, make it real. Get them out. And the sneakers, too, from the CIA and special forces. I don't think they wear boots. Number two, stop sending weapons to everybody and their brother who says they're fighting against ISIS or fighting against Assad or fighting whoever. This is the hardest one of all. Why? Because of the power of the military construct in this country. The people who make the bombs and build the planes and make the profits off of it, they're making a killing. So when you hear people say, well, no one wants this war, it's really not true. Most of us don't want this war. But there's a few people, very powerful people, who do. They're the ones who are making a profit off of it, who are selling the bombs and the planes and everything else to the Saudis and the Turks and the Jordanians and the Qataris and the UAE and everybody else, and sending them directly here too. It's not working. They all end up in the hands of the most extreme elements. So all this talk about, well, we're only sending it to the vetted, moderate, secular ones, you know, yeah, right, until they get run over by ISIS or whoever. Just stop doing that and move towards a full arms embargo. If we're serious about wanting the other side to stop arming the Syrian regime, for instance, you know, you hear U.S. officials saying, well, Russia and Iran must stop arming the Assad regime. Well, I agree with that. It's a terrible regime. They should stop arming them. But why do we think we have any credibility at all when we're sending arms to everybody else that's trying to overthrow the Assad regime? Who would listen to that? So it's got to be an arms embargo on all sides, and we can start that by stopping the arms shipments that's going to the rebels. Some of that's beginning to be talked about a little bit in the new pressure on Saudi Arabia that's happening in Washington. You know, the U.S. has sent, just under President Obama, $115 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and they're using it illegally in Yemen and sending it off to be used illegally in Syria. This is a mess. Number three, we need new diplomacy, real diplomacy, and it's not going to be easy. Maybe something will happen on Saturday when there's this new diplomatic meeting that Secretary Kerry has called together. I'm not terribly optimistic, but that's worth hoping for at least. But we need real diplomacy that's aimed at ending the war and not just aimed at being more efficient in the bombing, which was one of the big problems in that last U.S.-Russia agreement that collapsed after about a week. It wasn't aimed at stopping the war. It was aimed at dividing one group of rebels from another so the U.S. and the Russians could go in together and bomb everybody. They want to bomb ISIS. They want to bomb al-Qaeda, but they don't want to bomb the others. You know, this is not going to work. You can't have diplomacy that's aimed at better bombing and think that's going to lead to an end to the war. So we need real diplomacy that's aimed at ending the war. The fourth, and the only one that I think we might have a chance of getting somewhere soon, has to do with the humanitarian crisis. You all know some of the statistics. Half the population of Syria has been displaced from their homes in the last 5 years. 10 million of them. It's a number that's just staggering. Half, meaning it's actually a little more than half, about 6 million are displaced within Syria. 5.5 million or so are refugees outside of Syria, overwhelmingly in the countries surrounding Syria. There is a huge refugee crisis in places like Lebanon, where now one out of every three or four people in the country is a Syrian refugee. One quarter to one third of the population in the country. It's as if 150 million Canadians were somehow dropped in our shores with nothing but the shirt on their back, no food, no water, no education plans for their kids, no job, no nothing, and we suddenly are responsible for taking care of them. You know, that's the crisis in Lebanon. In Jordan, a country that doesn't have sufficient water for its own population, is now dealing with over 1 million Syrian refugees. This is a refugee crisis. Here, we don't have a refugee crisis here. We have a racism crisis here that's prohibiting more refugees from coming. And I've got to say, one of the outrages right now is to hear our government officials bragging, proud, of our taking 10,000, a measly 10,000 refugees over an entire year, who have all spent about 2 years being vetted and another year before that in a refugee camp being vetted by the UN before they even get to the vetting process that we impose. And 78% of them are women and children. And they're still taking 2 years or so to be vetted by the U.S. And we're proud of that? Germany last summer was taking twice that daily. And we're proud of taking 10,000 in a year. So we need a real campaign here to say we want Syrian refugees. Not because, well, don't worry, we'll make sure that it's only the good guys and we'll make sure they're safe. You know, it's because we want to welcome them. We're a country that claims to be based on refugees. You know, the give us your tired, your poor, unless they're Muslim or Arab. It's shocking. It's not maybe surprising, but it's shocking that our attitude has turned into such xenophobia and Islamophobia that's so bound up with this anti-refugee position. So we need a campaign to build support for refugees and build support for ending the war, not winning the war. Nobody's going to win this war. But we need a campaign that says we've got to end it. That means an arms embargo. Doesn't happen soon, but we've got to start talking about it, so eventually it will. Thank you.
On New World Notes, we've been listening to Phyllis Bennis speaking in Boston on ending the many wars in Syria. Thanks again to Dave Goodman of IBIS Radio, who made the original recording. I have edited out a stumble or two. The talk you heard was otherwise uncut. A few words from me, if you will forbear. 2016 is an election year, you may have noticed. And in this election year, as almost always, the two major party candidates have been trying to outdo each other in saber-rattling, in worship of soldiers and veterans, and in promises to further increase the already obscenely high levels of spending on the U.S. military machine. The United States has been at war in the Third World continuously for, I think, every day of my life. And I am 66 years old. Sometimes it's a big-ish war, as in Korea and later Vietnam. Sometimes it's been small wars, often three or four of them at once, such as now. In non-military terms, every war we have waged has ranged from counterproductive to a disaster. Even in military terms, every war has ranged from counterproductive to a disaster. With one military exception. One war was a good military success. That was our war against our evil enemy, Grenada. Our mighty, implacable, evil enemy, Grenada. Our proudest victory since VJ Day. October 25, 1983, our glorious war began. I will leave it to you to find Grenada on the map. If your eyesight is good enough and you have enough time, you probably can. But let us speak only of recent years. The U.S. invasion and bombing of Afghanistan, then Iraq, then Libya, proved three consecutive unmitigated disasters. Ongoing unmitigated disasters. Disasters not only to the poor people living there, but also to the world at large, including to the United States of America. So now, the war hawks are all shrieking to do it again in Syria. A long-standing, card-carrying, vociferous leader of the war hawks is our former senator and former Secretary of State, Hillary R. Clinton. Her Republican opponent has been a little less bellicose, particularly in matters involving Russia, which would include Syria. But Mr. Trump, too, is far more hawk than dove. That's how we used to talk back in the 60s, hawks versus doves. Either way, no matter who wins, we can expect four more years of bloody warfare, leaving the world a more miserable and more dangerous place than it had been beforehand. which is quite an achievement. And good news for Lockheed Martin, as Bennis reminds us. As we're promoting regime change by bombing Damascus, will any of us reflect upon the disasters that followed this very same action we committed upon Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan? Probably not. The late Gore Vidal used to refer to this country as the United States of Amnesia. From darkest Connecticut, if memory serves, this is Kenneth Doust for New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thank you for listening. And speaking of amnesia, let's go out with a little music, an oldie by Midnight Oil. Illegitimi non carborundum and ciao.
Shot memory. Plantation in Virginia. The Raj in British India. The deadline in South Africa. Shot memory. The story of El Salvador. The silence of Hiroshima. Destruction of Cambodia. Shot memory. Hilton style with running water specially bought, shot memory. A smallish man, Afghanistan, a watchdog in a nervous land. They're only there to lend a hand, shot memory. The friendly five, a dusty smile, wake up in sweat at dead at night. Shot memory. Shot memory must have a shot memory. Shot memory must have a shot memory. Shot memory must have a shot memory.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined on the show by the Green Party candidate for Congress from the 1st Congressional District, Mike DeRosa. The Democratic candidate, John Larson, and the Republican candidate, Matthew Corey, were also invited to participate, but they didn't respond to my email requests for them to be on the show. And in a follow-up call to their offices, I could not reach anyone at Corey's office and was told by a staff member at Larson's office that he had a prior commitment. So let's begin our discussion with the Green Party candidate from the 1st Congressional District. Mike DeRosa, welcome to the show.
Cheryl, thank you so much for having me on.
So tell me, Mike, what motivated you to run for Congress in the 1st Congressional District against a guy who's been there for 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest issue is the issue of the two major parties having dominance over the political dialogue. And I think that there are legitimate third party and fourth party and fifth party positions. And the Green Party is my party of choice. And that's what it's all about. And my slogan in my campaign for Congress is more voices and more choices in the U.S. Congress now. And that's really my motivating factor, is to say that we need a lot more scrutiny of our Congress because it is not doing its job when it comes to oversight. And that was one of the main reasons, which I'm sure we'll get into as we go through the program, about why I was running, because we have these endless wars and we don't have any declaration of war. What are we doing in Yemen? I have no idea what that's about.
They're a big threat to us.
Right. There's a civil war going on there. There's four different groups who are trying to get power there. Why are we siding with a major power to intervene in that country? And there isn't, and there hasn't been, a good reason for why we're involved there. And the Congress should be having hearings about what we're doing there and other places, including Syria and other places.
We're at an institution of higher learning here. Tell us what you would do to help students out with all this student debt. I mean, these kids are dying under all of this debt. You know, starting your life out that way is pretty horrible. What would you do to help them out?
Well, I think that this is one of the critical issues of this campaign. And I am very concerned about what's going on with our student population and the student debt that they are amassing. This is debt that they will never be able to pay back. And it's creating, in my opinion, a debt colony managed by the 1%. And this is not hyperbole. What we have here are private financial institutions who know that if students default, the U.S. government will pay them off. And so they have no incentive in any meaningful way. There's a few programs out there, but there was just a study done about a week ago. It was publicized a week ago that said that the attempts to rehabilitate, as they say, students who have defaulted has failed. And that one out of three will go back into default. And once you go into default the second time, it's all over. So a lot of this debt was accumulated under false pretenses. We have a lot of problems at our universities today because what's going on is the government is shifting money away from education into war, into really corruption. And what's going on is that students and families are now assuming the costs of education, especially in state education. Now, let me give you a really graphic example of what I'm talking about. I graduated from the University of Connecticut. I got a BA in history in 1966. My tuition costs at the University of Connecticut were $100 per semester. for as many credits as you want. Today, the cost of the same education at the University of Connecticut is $13,336, give or take a few bucks. And that's just the tuition. I paid $620 a year. That included the $200 for tuition and $420 for room and board. Now you can say, well, Mike, things were less expensive back then. The average person made $6,200 during that period. I checked it out. I remember it. I'm living history, as it were. And today, the average person makes about $50,000. So the bottom line in all of this is that there's a great discrepancy. Basically, it's $1 to $3 today in terms of what the average person makes to get a full education based on the yearly salary of the average person. Maybe one out of four, $1 every $4. When I went to school, it was one out of 30 or one out of $31. Now, what is the ratio here? You know, the ratio is way out of whack. Inflation hasn't gone up that much. It hasn't gone up to the point where it's anything like what I was dealing with back then. And this is true of my opponent, John Larson. John went to Central Connecticut State University in 1971, and I discussed this at the meeting, and his proposal, as far as I know, the only thing he brought up at the debate that I was involved with him, was that we should allow these students to work off their debt through public service. So why did John and I get a free education at state universities? And now he's asking this whole generation to work off their debt.
And sometimes their debts are huge. They're $150,000, $200,000 these kids are paying off. So it's, you know, a long time to work that off also. And that leads me to my next question, unless you wanted to pick up on that. No. Almost 60%, or I think it might even be more than that now, 60% of our federal budget goes to the Department of Defense, the military, in some way. And in other countries, they can provide free university education for their young people. If we didn't spend so much on the military here, couldn't we do that here? And secondly, what would you do to reduce that military budget and get us out of all these wars that we're in?
Well, the first issue is that this is Keynesian militarism. What is going on is that we are supporting a military-industrial congressional media complex to the tune of well over $1 trillion if you include what it's going to cost us in interest. The War Resisters League has done some serious research about this, and it's about $1.3 trillion if you include all of the ancillary costs and the interest that's related to this over a period of 30 or 40 years. And we have this situation now where essentially what's going on is we're creating jobs in the military. We produce this hardware. We have to do something to get rid of it so we can produce more jobs. So we have these wars all over the world. There's also the involvement of the U.S. in the oil industry. And this is part of our reason for being in the Middle East. It may not even be a case of necessarily grabbing the oil and selling it. Like in Libya, we overthrew the government there and they stopped pumping oil. Well, this was really good for a lot of oil producing countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and some of these other places where that's their main industry. Here, our industry is the military. So what we're talking about is cutting the military budget in half. And the only way we can do that is to reduce the number of wars that we have around the world. And why are we at war with everybody? I think the real problem here is that what we're doing is we're doing things that are not in our self-interest. For example, a lot of economists will say if you have a military job and you spend $1 billion on military jobs, get about 7,000 jobs per $1 billion. If you use it for education, it's up about 22,000 jobs. If you use it for a green job, it's up about 24,000 jobs. If you put it into any other activity which is peaceful and productive, it's well over 18,000 jobs. So what's really going on is that these are high-tech industries whose main purpose is to create military weapons, which are then used indiscriminately to kill people in other countries. Most of these wars are illegal and they're unconstitutional. None of them have been approved in any significant way by the UN, which is required for it to be legal. But even under our Constitution, these wars are not legal because there's not a declaration of war. And I will demand as a congressman from Connecticut that we have a declaration of war before we go bomb someplace. And I'm also going to be very concerned and sagacious about the idea of enforcing the War Powers Act, because the War Powers Act is being ignored by the Congress. Now, there's a few people on the left in the Congress and a few people on the right of the Congress who agree with me. Many of them have their own little group, and I would join that group. I don't know what you would call it. I think everybody else is the war party, so maybe we're the anti-war party.
We have United Technologies here, Pratt & Whitney, making war machines. What would you do about that?
Oh, we can convert these industries. And there, over the years, there have been many proposals put forward by the International Machinists and many other unions. And they attempted to diversify these industries because basically what you have when you're making a motor is you're creating a mechanical device, which can be used for transportation, creation of energy. There are many, many things that could be done in an electric boat. They build boats. Why couldn't we build boats down there? The other part of it, of course, is that we have in every congressional district in the United States, we either have a base or a factory. I mean, look at the commercials that are being put out by the Democrats, Blumenthal and John Larson. What they're saying is, you know, we saved these military jobs for you, so we should be immediately elected. I find this very, very troubling. And I think that we need leadership. And I really like John Larson. I think he's a very good guy. He always allows me in the debates. He seems to be open to ideas. He's willing to discuss things. But like a lot of people, he is part of the problem in that he has been captured by these interests. And he's has a high position in the Congress. And he has very little flexibility in terms of addressing these issues. And I know that he has voted against these wars, but then he turns around and votes for this bloated military budget. And this is a contradiction which I find unacceptable.
What would you do? You know, we're enmeshed in Syria right now and are still in Iraq. We've destroyed Libya. Afghanistan is falling apart and we're still there. What would you do in Syria with ISIS? It looks like all the evidence that I've uncovered shows that it's actually the U.S. and its allies there that are funding, supporting, and have created ISIS. It's like a spinoff of Al-Qaeda there. So what would you do to get us out of Syria and get that situation under control?
Well, let's go back to General Wesley Clark. General Wesley Clark was NATO commander. He's not a peacenik. And he was in the Pentagon 4 days or 5 days after 9/11, and he was talking to some of his military buddies, and one of them came up and said, you know, I got this memo from Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and so forth that we're going to overthrow seven governments in the next 5 years in the Middle East. And he says, this is crazy. I don't understand it. What have these countries done to us? Why are we going to overthrow them? And that was the beginning of our Middle East adventures. It goes even earlier, certainly with the Bushes, to the first Gulf War, and even earlier than that. So the issue is that these wars, in my opinion, and I think in the opinion of Wesley Clark, because he keeps talking about this in his book and in speeches, that there's something unusual going on here. Why are we overthrowing secular countries in the Middle East and pandering to religious fanatics who run essentially dictatorships? And the big untold story of Hillary Clinton and the Benghazi situation is not that she had simply a server which was not secured. I mean, that's certainly part of it. But real question here is there was an illegal gun running operation and an illegal terrorist operation that took place in Benghazi when Gaddafi was overthrown. And there's a lot of evidence, it's prima facie evidence, that these weapons that were in Libya were transported to Syria. And this was used to start a war there. So why are we instigating these things? Why is the CIA, these orders are coming from on high. And the real question is, do we want this to be our foreign policy? I think we have a right as citizens of the United States to ask questions about what happened there. And we need to have serious investigations of what's been going on in this country, particularly about the surveillance state, about assassinations that have taken place over the last 30, 40 years, and false flag operations, if you want to call them that. All of our congressional investigations on the JFK murder were subverted. The Warren Commission and then the Select Committee on Assassinations, they were stopped from really finishing the job, and that can be proven. So we need really good investigations. And we did have a few with the Church Committee and the Rockefeller Committee and the Irvin Committee. They looked into these matters and found out some information that was not readily available, and it changed some of our policy. And the problem is that in American history, there are periods where we go up and down. We have an upsurge of this sort of militarism and surveillance state and repression, and then another party comes along and taps that down. We saw that in the First World War. It happened during the Cold War. It's happened for many, many years. But what we have now is a situation where the two parties work together. I call them the war party. And essentially what they're selling is war, war, and more war. And what the Green Party is selling is peace, prosperity, jobs, justice, and freedom. And that's what we're all about.
Yeah. And those seven countries that Wesley Clark stated that you just mentioned were Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Sudan, and Somalia. And, I think there's only one left that we haven't been meddling in, and that would be Iran. And I'm pretty sure they've added Russia and China to the list now also, although that's just my own opinion. But, Mike, you brought up these investigations, and since this is a show about 9/11, what would you do if elected to look into and expose the truth about 9/11?
Well, we have to have an investigation of 9/11. We didn't really have an investigation. I mean, it was a whitewash of the worst type. And the initial investigation, when the questions about Building 7 came out, they didn't even have a section in it. They said, well, we don't know what happened. It took them years later to come up with a theory, which doesn't hold water, about how that collapse took place. And that's the smoking gun in New York City. But there's certainly a need for a thorough investigation of what 9/11 was, who perpetrated it, how deeply we were involved in it. If at all, we don't know. I mean, these are the questions. I have my own suppositions. There are a lot of citizen investigators out here that are getting a lot of pushback. Right now, all you have to say is you're a conspiracy theorist, and everything you say after that is dismissed as tin foil hat nonsense. You know, some of this is true, and we need to find out the truth about what happened on 9/11, because it has influenced the last 16 years of our existence here in the United States and has poisoned the political process and has created much mayhem and death all over the world. And there should be a reason for that.
Yeah. And you had mentioned these false flag events, of which 9/11 was one. But there's also been the domestic terrorism, and many of those, and even Fox News talks about this, many of those have been set up. These people have been groomed and entrapped by the FBI, often mentally unsound people, to do these domestic terrorist events. What would you do about that? Would you have some kind of investigation, or how would you go after that, the truth about those?
Our Constitution is based on the principle of shared power. When the Founding Fathers put it together, they were aware of the fact that there had been other attempts at democracy, at a republic in the past. And they knew that, military dictators ultimately, or empire builders, took over those countries. For example, Rome became an empire. And I know one thing for a fact, and that is that you can't have an empire and a republic. You either can have an empire or you can have a republic. And the empire is gaining power. Now, to refer back to your question, all empires need enemies. This is how they survive. Internal enemies, external enemies. This is part of the paradigm that makes empires possible and makes them survive. So I think that part of what we have to do in the Congress is to be the independent watchdog of what is going on in domestic policies. These agencies that we know very little about, these secret agencies, are perpetuating criminal activity. They're kind of a murder incorporated. And this is what came out of the church committee, where all the assassinations, all of the false flag operations, all the black bag jobs that were taking place in the 50s and 60s and 70s. I was aware of this as an activist in the 60s. I ran into it all over the place. Agent provocateurs being put into operations. Now you can go to Paranoid's Paradise so we can find out the truth. So I would be pushing very hard for serious investigations of all these matters, so that this is the responsibility of the Congress. It's supposed to be an independent agency to keep control over the executive branch, whatever the executive branch is. And the judiciary is there to be a third force that is available for the people. Now, the House of Representatives is supposed to be the House of the people. It's not supposed to be the House of the special interests.
Right. And how would you react if you were elected to Congress in the first district here and you were approached by lobbyists and corporations and everybody trying to offer you funds for your campaign? How would you react to them?
Well, I don't take any corporate money during my campaign. I don't want corporate money. I will take money from individuals, but I will not take money from corporations. And that's, I think, how we have to operate. Do corporations have a right to express their opinion? No. Are they persons? No, I don't think they're persons, because a corporation can live forever. We as humans do not live forever. So they can recreate themselves. They can create their own mothers and fathers and reproduce themselves. That's not what we can do. So they're not really biological persons in any sense of the word, and they're certainly not political persons in any sense of reality. This is part of the problem, is that the corporate state controls our media, it controls our military, it controls our politicians. It's time for politicians to stand up and say, no, we're not going to take this money, and say that these other folks out here that are taking their money, that people shouldn't vote for them, you know?
Since 9/11, our civil liberties have been encroached on, and we've lost a lot of our civil liberties, and we've become more like a police state. What would you do if elected to rein in the NSA from all the surveillance, the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act that allows the president to murder Americans just because he suspects that they might be involved in terrorism? No proof, just a suspicion.
Well, first of all, we have something called the Fourth Amendment, and that is not being enforced. We also have the 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law, and we have the First Amendment, free speech, and we have laws that cover these areas. They need to be enforced. I mean, it's quite simple. If we have a problem with the NSA, which some people call no such agency, then we need to have hearings and we need to ask the difficult questions from these people and find out why they're violating the Fourth Amendment with impunity, I might add. And we need to support whistleblowers. Ed Snowden is exiled in Russia for what? For doing what any honest American would do, which is to say that the government is violating its own laws and that people need to know about it. Julian Assange is locked up in an Ecuadorian embassy in a small room there. He's being held hostage to the U.S. government, to the Swedish government, to other governments, including the U.K. He's a major embarrassment because he's telling us about information that we're not supposed to know about. And they want to kill him and they want to get rid of him. Hillary Clinton said, they say it was in jest in some of these WikiLeaks exposures. You know, can we drone this guy? I mean, what is this supposed to mean? A major candidate for president in the United States is talking about killing someone. And they said, oh, it was in jest. She didn't really mean it. Well, she kept talking about it for 5 or 10 minutes, according to the WikiLeaks people that were quoted at the meeting. So, again, Chelsea Manning, a very brave private in the military, you know, he's going to be in a cage for the rest of his life simply because he exposed a video which showed illegal things going on, the killing of civilians, and also expose other information. If we don't let these people speak, then we will not know what our government is doing in our name. And it's certainly important that Congress get on board and investigate this and put a stop to this stuff, because it is not helping our foreign policy. It is creating enemies to the United States all over the world. And it really is hypocritical, because how can we stand up and talk about peace and freedom and justice, that we stand up for these things as a nation and perform these illegal and unconstitutional acts and create mayhem all over the world. What is the purpose of this? If they want to build an empire, that's fine, but let's tell people that we're not going to have a republic anymore, that we're going to have an empire, and then we can have the American empire. But, you know, if we want a republic and, in my opinion, a democracy, then we need to stand up and speak out. And that's why I'm running for Congress. I'm running for Congress because I believe that the American people want this type of government. And if they had a chance to hear about it and if they had a chance to discuss it, they would embrace it. And it's the idea of free speech is it's not free. And if you don't use it, you're going to lose it.
Mike, one last question. Can you tell me what kind of obstacles the two-party system puts in front of third parties so that they can't really get on the ballot and run it? What kind of obstacles are there?
Well, it's very pervasive and it's very insidious. A person who was the head of the Political Science Association of America said the two major parties are basically on life support. And the two things that keep them alive are a whole lot of money, like we're talking, you know, billions of dollars, and control over ballot access. And so each state has different ballot access laws. We were very sagacious this year. We collected 16,800 signatures, more than twice as much as we needed, and we needed them because we wouldn't have been on the ballot. So this is the way they suppress alternative viewpoints and alternative parties. We all know that all parties in Connecticut are equal, but some parties are more equal than others. And we're discriminated against in the media. I can't tell you the number of media people I've called to get no response back from them. So I really appreciate an opportunity to be on this show and to be able to speak freely. And I think that most Americans agree with what I'm saying. And what they're convincing people is you have to vote for the lesser of the two evils. Well, that's baloney. If you vote for the lesser of the two evils, you're going to get the evil of the two lessers. And the other problem is that there really isn't two parties. There's only one party. And what you have a choice in this election is the alternative parties or big brother or big sister. And this coin has been minted, and no matter how many times you throw it up in the air, when it lands, it's heads you lose, tails you lose. So it's time to stand up and say once and for all that we need a change and we need to vote for what we want and what we need instead of what they're serving us, which is just, in my opinion, more war, more destruction, more economic disasters, more educational disasters. We have a plan. It's called the Green New Deal, and it's about peace, freedom, and justice. And I hope people will step up and vote for one of the third parties this year because your life may depend on it.
Well, Mike, thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate your coming on and talking. I know the other two candidates couldn't make it, so I appreciate your being here.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, and I would leave our listeners with the following phrase, vote clean, vote green.
Okay. And as Ralph Nader said, vote your conscience.
Absolutely. And thanks again for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. And again, you were just listening to a discussion with Green Party candidate Mike DeRosa, who's running for Congress in the 1st Congressional District, representing the state of Connecticut. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is the Taylor Report. It is CIT 89.5 FM. We're going to be speaking soon with Tiffen Dixon. She was a lawyer at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And we assumed that she is very interested in the Globe and Mail front page story, which reads, Rwanda genocide is the subhead, and the full head is Kagame government blocked. UN tribunal probe, Arbour says. And it's written by Michelle Zilio of Ottawa and Jeffrey York, and based in Johannesburg. And it has this revelation that our former Supreme Court Justice is acknowledging a glitch. And we need to explore that with Tiffen Dixon, who had practiced law there at the International Criminal Tribunal, knows a thing or two about this matter and probably some things about Louise Arbour. I think she has joined us. Are you there, Tiffen?
Hi, Phil.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
We're very glad that you could talk to us. I was just telling our listeners that the headline on the Globe and Mail story is Kagame government blocked, UN tribunal probe. And this is, and the first paragraph says, a United Nations criminal tribunal was so hobbled by the hostility of the Rwandan government that it was unable to investigate, quote, very credible allegations of crimes by the forces of Paul Kagame. President Paul Kagame says Louise Arbour, the tribunal's former chief prosecutor. And they also indicate further on in the story that there was credible, the line that taken from her is that credible evidence that Paul Kagame had been involved in the assassination of President Habyarimana of Rwanda and Cyprien Ntaryamira, I think his name is, and of course all the others on the plane, April 6, 1994. This is, of course, 2016. You were in court in 1997 defending Mr. George Rutaganda, and I think we need to hear from you what you make of this, just starting with this point. Arbour, this is many years later, she is telling us something rather important. What's your assessment of this?
Well, first I want to say that it's the prosecution being hobbled by the Rwandan government is certainly not breaking news. And I'm pretty sure that you have reported on this on your show for maybe 20 years.
For a little while. We've even spoken to a man named Hurigan who shows up in the story.
Yes.
More than once.
Yes.
The Globe and
yes.
Mail wasn't able to find him at that time, but we noticed that he had a phone number and an address and a legal practice, so we called him up.
Yeah, and thank you so much for doing that. Thank you so much for getting him on the record before he sadly passed away. Mm-hmm. So the way it's framed by Louise Arbour is a little bit disingenuous. One gets a sense in reading the story that she and I guess the office of the prosecutor, I mean, in the choice of the verbs, right? They were hobbled. Mm-hmm. They're the real victims here. And certainly from my perspective, having been a defense lawyer at the ICTR, it's very difficult to have a tremendous amount of compassion and sympathy for the prosecutor's office that I will argue let themselves be manipulated by the Kagame government and meekly followed their orders throughout, resulting in a number of cruel injustices.
Mm-hmm. And of course you raised the word victim. I know you won't like the label, but you were trying to defend your client, and you asked that United Nations prosecutor at the Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda for disclosure. This story bears on what happened with that experience. It seems we've asked you about this previous, but it seems more poignant now. As a matter of fact, that's why we wanted to call you back so soon. We've spoken to you a couple of weeks ago over other revelations that are coming out about suspicions of Kagame's involvement in the assassination, which is so central.
Yeah.
And you were very helpful to us then. But at that time, you did not have in your hands Arbour saying, yes, she was quite aware of this phenomenon. Although she didn't volunteer to talk about Mr. Hourigan. Apparently, the Globe raised it with her. But what about your right to your client's right to a fair trial and due process and a big word with lawyers, disclosure? Talk about what happened to you the prosecution.
So I first want to say that it's not just me, and I'm looking at the transcript from the February 7th, 1997. Almost 20 years old, and I even argue that it's not just about Rutaganda, but all the accused,
mm-hmm.
and indeed for history, that the prosecution disclose the results of investigations into the shooting down of President Habyarimana's plane,
mm-hmm.
And it was materially relevant in the case of Rutaganda. I mean, I'll get back to that.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed to me at the time not to be such a controversial request.
Mm-hmm.
I had even tried to hedge by stating or by petitioning that if they did not have an investigation into the shooting down of the plane, that the court direct the prosecutor's office to investigate the shooting down of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened in the courtroom that morning was rather astonishing. On his oath of office, the representative of the prosecutor then responds that they don't have investigations into the shooting down of the plane. And I quote, our responsibility and mandate is not to investigate plane crashes.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really our function. Therefore, I would categorically answer this question by saying that first, we don't have such investigation. We have not made any such investigation, and we don't have any reports. And secondly, it is not our function, it is not our mandate to investigate plane crashes or presidents, vice presidents, or whoever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, this is really a matter not within our province.
Mm-hmm. That's what he said. And meanwhile, an investigation had gone on and was going on, right? And incidentally, I get the implication from the story that there was even a second investigation, not only the one we could call the Hourigan investigation.
Correct.
But something else.
Right.
Something further.
Yeah, what that would seem to be was an investigation that former prosecutor Carla Del Ponte had requested to her special investigations team. And this is referred to in the previous Globe story as a report bearing the classification top secret from
mm-hmm.
2003 and setting out evidence with respect to offenses committed by the RPF, the current Rwandan regime, and including a reference to investigations on the shooting down of the plane and an implication that that the RPF was to blame.
Mm-hmm.
And so my understanding is that after after Carla Del Ponte was removed from her position as prosecutor of the ICTR.
Guilty of carrying out her duties.
Well, yeah, guilty of carrying out her duties and guilty in particular of not having caved to the pressure brought upon her in Washington by the U.S. Ambassador for War Crimes Issues, who had been a previously prosecutor at the ICTR, who had her there in Washington in some State Department office with the Rwandan delegation, asking her to agree, asking her to literally sign on to a document stating that she would not undertake investigations against the RPF.
By the way, just to add a little melodrama, the way theater people would, that gentleman was in the courtroom when as a deputy prosecutor, when the one answering your questions denied they had any that they investigated plane crashes.
That's correct.
He was sitting alongside.
He was sitting alongside.
He gets around.
And the transcripts show that he's a little cannier than his colleagues. He does not say that there are no investigations, because we know that there was an investigation. We learned that in 2000 when the revelations of Mr. Hourigan were published in the National Post.
Mm-hmm.
So Prosper, I guess being perhaps a more clever attorney than his colleague, refers only to the lack of relevance.
Mm-hmm.
of disclosure of elements regarding the shooting down of President Javier Jimenez's plane to my client's case.
Mm-hmm. Well, this bears on – it was so important that this came up, and you're right. It was really impacted all cases because the people around the world who were aware of the horror of the story, the assassination and then the war and then all the massacres, when they heard there was going to be a tribunal, there was, it seems to me, some sleight of hand practiced, because Mr. Goldstone, who was the original chief prosecutor, indicated that he was going to look into the plane crash. That was going to be part of the mandate.
Yes.
And then he goes out of the door and Louise Arbour comes in, and then we don't hear about that investigation anymore. Yet the implication hung over all trials that the evil, etc., extremist Hutus had done it, had they had assassinated Habimana. That was a prosecution theory.
Yep.
But they didn't prosecute that crime. And so the cloud was over throughout the trials, and to this day, frankly, I mean, I don't know how many people in the world have heard what Ms. Arbour has to say. But there was a kind of sneak, unstated case or unproven case, which people were permitted to believe that it was Hutus who had done it, or the extremists, when in fact there was no evidence.
That's absolutely correct, and in fact, if they incrementally stopped loudly claiming that the Hutu extremists had shot down the plane because President Habyarimana was becoming too soft or making too many concessions in the context of the Arusha Accords, it is, I think, due in large part to their reluctance to talk about their own investigations into the shooting down of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
They began to quiet down in terms of that theory, and that led us led folks to be suspicious about what the results of that investigation might have been.
Mm-hmm.
Why are they reluctant to communicate these results, and why are they B, no longer insisting on this prosecution theory, and instead changing tack and saying that the assassination of President Habyarimana is irrelevant, that the genocide was pre-planned anyway. This is a spark, but it's an accidental spark.
Yes, but then at the end of the day, when the trial closed up, they hadn't proven that there was any pre-planning. So
right.
So then you can take your ticket and go into the wilderness, because now it's all a ghost town, and the court that you imagined was there has disappeared. And all these men are, and one woman are sitting in prison or in a kind of a limbo, despite the revelations that you and I are talking about. We're speaking to Tiffan Dixon. She was the lead counsel in the case of Rutaganda George, to say it properly, was the lawyer who challenged, demanded of the prosecution that he disclose what he knew about the any investigations of the shooting down. And we may as well share with our listeners, the prosecution never used the word shooting down. They actually used language which would permit you to think that the plane had fallen from the sky all by its lonesome.
Yes. So
you on your side would mention it occasionally, or when you got the opportunity, that missiles struck that plane, two of them. Whereas the prosecutor could not say that.
No.
It would not come out of his mouth.
They would only refer to crashes.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I read then, February 1997, we don't investigate plane crashes, presidents, vice presidents, whoever.
Mm-hmm.
This was a practice that extended right to my client's judgment.
Mm-hmm.
In the court's judgment finding George Rutaganda guilty, the reference is not to a shootdown, but to a crash.
A plane crash.
Failing entirely to acknowledge the fact that, okay, the plane did crash. Before it crashed, it was attempting to land at Kigali Airport and was hit by two SAM-16 missiles.
Mm-hmm.
It's not honest to refer to that as a
yes.
crash.
Yes. By the way, why wouldn't you know if they weren't somewhat playing a guilty hand? Why wouldn't they enthusiastically join with you in just using those words if there wasn't something a little odd about their case?
Yeah, it just shows that the prosecution was most likely that day when I presented that motion,
mm-hmm.
Lied under his oath of office.
Mm-hmm.
If you do have evidence to show that Hutu extremists shot down that plane, then of course you're going to call it a shoot down.
Mm-hmm. And you bring your evidence.
You bring your evidence.
Get it over with.
If you have evidence that's not suiting your larger thesis of pre-planned genocide, or this is germane to the Globe story, or if your evidence suggests that perhaps Paul Kagame himself was involved in the shooting down of the plane, and that you have put yourself in a position where you're totally reliant on the Rwandan government from visas to witnesses,
mm-hmm.
and cooperation generally. Well, then they're not going to disclose that evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Louise Arbour said it herself. We didn't have the capacity.
Uh-huh. Well, by the way, and the obvious question is, should they? She, in her facing her duties as a member of the bar, et cetera, and a former justice of the Canadian mm-hmm. court, shouldn't you say, I can't do my work, we're going to have to shut this down? Or a second question, too, is that if the government of Paul Kagame threatens you and says you can't do this and you can't do that, can't you charge him with contempt? Isn't that the appropriate thing to do?
I mean, that is the ideal type legalist view.
Oh, that's me.
And what she's saying in this article, and what we've been observing for two decades now, is that that's not realistic. So, I mean, there was an interesting twist.
Not realistic. Thank you. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, the Rwandan government has suspended cooperation on several occasions. They've shown that they're absolutely prepared to put a chokehold on prosecution witnesses coming to Arusha. and the prosecutor was not prepared to face those kinds of consequences. Mm-hmm. But there's an interesting twist on this by Del Ponte when she was asked to sign this document stating that she wouldn't prosecute RPF crimes out in Washington. So apparently she had offered another way to do this. She said, "Have the Security Council modify the statute of the tribunal, stating that the prosecutor can only investigate one side of the conflict and cannot investigate the RPF." And that's called calling the bluff.
Yes. Yeah, put your cards on the table. You don't get to use a joker anymore.
Right. And this court only investigates and prosecutes one side. Mm-hmm. Maybe we shouldn't call it a court anymore.
Well, I'm afraid you're right. And by the way, now... And just in addition, we want to remember that Del Ponte point, that when it came time to make any decisions, the Americans were there. And I do recall the case of Mr. Baraguiza, who the court ordered freed with prejudice. They used the word with prejudice. Like today, open the prison door and let him out because of prosecution misconduct. And Kagame called and the Americans called. Only two parties called and said, don't do that. And so I think at least for that occasion, we had the two culprits in the same room. And they did get their way. Mr. Baraguiza died in prison.
Yep. That's true. And the Baraguiza decision was another instance of Rwanda immediately suspending all cooperation with the ICTR. They withdrew Prosecutor Del Ponte's visa at once. Mm-hmm. Their representative at the UN apparently cornered then president of the ICTR, who was Nivana Simpile at the time. Mm-hmm. Telling her not to apply this decision,
mm-hmm.
And she had said, and because now what we have with Arbour's statements is an acknowledgement that the prosecutor of the ICTR was never independent. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be independent. That's part of their mandate.
Yes.
But what we had from Pile after Baraguiza was an acknowledgement that the court wasn't independent of Kigali. Because she said, without the cooperation of Kigali, we can't hold a trial. Well,
that means no trials. If it's a justice system, right? Just don't have it.
If you can't be independent of a party that is supposed to be under investigation, nothing in the jurisdiction of the ICTR says to investigate only the previous government side. There's no such provision.
Well, Tiefen Dixon, isn't this then the argument that every should be Exhibit A for all those African countries who are tired of being threatened by the International Criminal Court or the International Caucasian Court, as the president of Guinea calls it? shouldn't this be Exhibit A? I mean, what are you guys doing? What kind of – and you Americans and Air Force colonels and former prosecutors from the U.S. and you're standing here in Africa, this is the kind of justice you give us.
No, that's absolutely right. This certainly is Exhibit A. Although you know most of them don't even most of those states on the African continent don't even need an additional exhibit. How the ICC has run its prosecutions is eloquent enough to warrant their decision to go. And they have a better. They already have a body. That they're setting up with a beautiful statute that makes aggression illegal, which the ICC has not managed to do yet, and the ICC that has an opt-out provision of aggression. That's the supreme international crime, and I'm only quoting Nuremberg decision.
Yes.
And there's now the ICC has an opt-out provision. Well, the body that the African Union is establishing has no such opt-out provision, and it has an idea of international crimes that's a lot more interesting than just those genocide crimes against humanity and violation of the Geneva Conventions. They've got some prohibition on human trafficking, drug trafficking, mercenaries on the African continent. So just let that in. What that would mean for the African continent, and also
maybe they could charge the occasional Frenchman or the occasional American if running around in camo in their countries.
Precisely, and actually, the definition that they've arrived upon would do just that. And well, speaking of prosecuting a Frenchman, that's what Rwanda has promised to do this morning.
Oh, over because they got tangled up in this thing. There's a French investigation of the plane, which, by the way, I mean, we have to agree that that's a politicized process in that they've had this evidence for 22 years themselves, and France has never wanted to bother Kagame.
Nope. And this gambit, sad to say, will probably yet again succeed.
Mm-hmm.
They've named 22 French officers this morning,
mm-hmm.
And I don't see France, certainly not under François Hollande.
Well, their phone rings from the U.S. the same as it does in Kigali. You know, they started off; they had everything they needed, but somebody, probably I assume a NATO power. Run from Washington, they said, no, you know, you're going to cause a problem for our friend Kagame. And let me ask you something also very relevant, and you were concerned about this, I know, as counsel. She also says that, and one of her spokesperson, Douglas Marks, is identified as one of the people for the prosecution side, I think. He said the problem was witnesses kept disappearing, people who knew about these things. And they're still disappearing. People are dying. And the dangerous places were Nairobi, where several very important witnesses knew all about this plane being shot down. Remember General Lazindi, but subsequently Sendashong, other people. Who's going to remedy the problem here? You did diligent work. You invited people to come and tell what they knew. And here's the prosecutor whining that they lost some people or could have because they knew things about Kagame. Well, how about the defense? And who's going to ever straighten this matter out? This is you have a basis to expect a remedy from the United Nations Security Council who created this monster.
Yes. So the point about witness protection is just so stunningly hypocritical. You know, we had to bend over backwards to get minimal and often, frankly, insufficient protection for witnesses who are being incredibly brave. This is an institution that doesn't have subpoenas, so mm-hmm. they have to decide to go. And we would argue what was true is that these witnesses were under threat for testifying for a defendant, or in some cases saying something critical about the current leadership of Rwanda, and this is something which was greeted with tremendous hostility,
mm-hmm.
and often, and I think it was feigned, but you know, feigned skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
How could witnesses be in danger in Nairobi? It's you know, maybe Rwanda, we might buy it, but not Nairobi. And mm-hmm. so I had to file. I filed a photograph of Seth Sendashonga that had been in the front page of the Nairobi Daily, The Nation.
Him in his car, you mean, blown to pieces?
Crushed over in his car, and you see the contents of his brain spilled over. I mean, that got filed into evidence. You want to say that Nairobi's safe?
Mm-hmm.
Nairobi is not safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then to read now that this is part of the excuse why they didn't investigate RPF crimes or the shooting down of the plane, because they might put people in danger. Well, they didn't seem to care that much when they were opposing our motions precisely to protect people in Nairobi or South Africa or other states around the world. So that struck me as callous.
Yes, somewhat.
It's callous, and you know, when you say that we should have some reparation, I mean, yes, there are many witnesses in many of these cases who were punished for having testified.
Yes.
who had their refugee claims challenged or even denied,
and some of them transferred back to Rwanda.
Yes,
eventually. Tiffin Dixon, we have to go, but we are very grateful, and we want to return to this subject because I think this whole thing is a new door on the matter has been opened. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yep. Tiffin Dixon, you've been listening to Taylor Report, and we thank Hanny, and we thank Phil Conlon, and we'll see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
You are making history tonight. This is the first legal civil marriage between two men or two women, and that is unique in the world.
Millions and millions of people will look at this and they will see that in the Netherlands it's possible for two men to get the same rights as every other married couple.
I want to say yes, but I could not. I just said yes.
Yes.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. U.S. top court tackles trans teen toilet rights, Google sees red over Singapore's pink dot restrictions, and a History Month happy anniversary for marriage equality. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending October 29th, 2016. The U.S. Supreme Court announced on October 28th that it would hear a case involving which public school campus bathroom a female-to-male transgender student can use.
I am fighting this fight because no kid should have to think so hard about performing a basic and private function of being alive. No kid struggling to be accepted and struggling to accept themselves should have to simultaneously battle for the right to use the correct bathroom.
A fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruling ordered the Gloucester County, Virginia School District to let Gavin Grimm use the boys' bathroom. The school board, which is appealing that decision, had instituted a policy requiring students to use bathrooms and locker rooms consistent with their biological genders and ordered students with gender identity issues to use separate private facilities. Because of the school board's appeal, Gavin is still forced to use separate bathrooms and locker rooms on his high school campus and to endure the corresponding humiliation. Through his ACLU lawyers, Grimm said that, "While I'm disappointed that I will have to spend my final school year being singled out and treated differently from every other guy, I will do everything I can to make sure that other transgender students don't have to go through the same experience."
The central issue in the case is the Obama administration's assertion that a 1972 civil rights law that includes banning discrimination on the basis of sex includes gender identity. The Department of Education issued a directive in May specifically warning schools that discriminating against transgender students could cost them federal funds. With the Supreme Court short one justice because of the refusal by the Republican leadership in the U.S. Senate to consider the president's nominee to replace the departed Antonin Scalia, a 4-4 tie would let the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court ruling in Grimm's favor stand, but it would not set national precedent. The case is expected to be heard early next year.
The LGBT rights group Equality Utah has sued the state's Board of Education over the board's policy banning any discussion of sexual and gender minorities in public school classrooms. The lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court in Salt Lake City and is the first of its kind in the country. At least seven other states, Alabama, Arizona, Louisiana, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas have similar no-promo-homo restrictions, which the Utah lawsuit says are violations of First Amendment free speech rights and equal protection rights guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. The National Center for Lesbian Rights brought the suit on behalf of Equality Utah and three public school students and their parents. It claims that enforced silence about LGBT people creates a hostile culture for sexual and gender nonconforming students, putting them at risk for isolation, harassment, and long-term negative impacts on their health and well-being. These laws prevent presentation of accurate information concerning lesbian, gay, and bisexual people in health classes and other classes, the lawsuit contends, even when such information serves important educational purposes, while imposing no similar restriction on discussion of heterosexuality. The district court has yet to schedule hearings in the case.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, launched a new website this week that stresses tolerance for same-sex attraction, and specifically debunks the idea that such attraction can be changed. Many people pray for years and do all they can to be obedient in an effort to reduce same-sex attraction, yet find they are still attracted to the same sex, the website reads. A change in attraction should not be expected or demanded as an outcome by parents or leaders. L. Whitney Clayton, an elder in the church, appears in a welcoming video on the site.
We have given much thought and care to better understanding the experience of same-sex attraction and making sure individuals who feel such attraction and their families feel welcome and part of the great worldwide family that is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We want you to be part of our congregations. You have great talents and abilities to offer God's kingdom on earth, and we recognize the many valuable contributions you make.
The seemingly softer stance, however, does not signal a change in core church doctrine that considers private consensual adult same-gender sex to be a sin and requires same-sex attracted congregants to remain celibate. The attraction itself is not a sin, but acting on it is, the website says. Even though individuals do not choose to have such attractions, they do choose how to respond to them. Mormons who act on their desires can be excommunicated from the church. Last year, a change in policy also declared that children of legally married same-gender couples can't be baptized until they turn 18 and renounce their parents' relationship.
In other news, Google is squaring off with the government of Singapore over sponsorship of the city-state's Pink Dot Festival. The annual event, celebrating LGBT love and equality, has grown by leaps and bounds since 2009 and has attracted sponsorships from several other multinationals, including Facebook, Apple, Twitter, Bloomberg, BP, and Goldman Sachs. In an effort to restrict that support going forward, the Ministry of Home Affairs announced plans soon after this year's Pink Dot in June to require foreign companies and individuals to get a permit to continue their sponsorships. The ministry emphasized in its announcement that the government's position has always been that foreign entities should not interfere in our domestic issues, especially those of a political or controversial nature. Under the new rules, sponsorships are now allowed only by companies incorporated or registered in Singapore and controlled by a majority of Singapore citizens. But a defiant Google issued a statement insisting that, "We will apply for a permit to support Pink Dot in 2017 if required by this new regulation. We hope that these new rules will not limit public discussion on important issues." There's been no word yet from any of the other multinational Pink Dot sponsors.
The British government has blocked a proposal in Parliament to pardon men convicted of violating laws banning private consensual adult gay sex before it was decriminalized in 1967. The bill would have posthumously pardoned thousands of men convicted of offenses under historical anti-gay laws if those acts would be legal today. Surviving men with convictions would have been automatically pardoned. The Turing bill was named after World War II hero Alan Turing, who was convicted in 1952 of gross indecency for having sex with another man. He chose chemical castration over jail time, but committed suicide 2 years later. The story of Turing breaking the Nazis' Enigma Code was dramatized in the Oscar-winning movie The Imitation Game. Turing was pardoned by Queen Elizabeth in 2013. After the royal pardon, a widely supported petition asked that all other men convicted of similar crimes be pardoned as well. But Justice Minister Sam Gyimah filibustered the private member bill in the House of Commons this week because the government feared extending automatic blanket pardons without requiring individual applications could exonerate some people convicted of offenses that are still crimes today.
Liberal Democrat Lord Sharkey is among lawmakers who've been campaigning for the pardons. He told the Australian Broadcasting Company why they're important.
There are about 65,000 men convicted under these now repealed anti-gay laws. 15,000 still alive, the others are dead. Their families suffered. They suffered directly in employment terms. The laws were very cruel and very unjust.
However, Lord Sharkey's government-backed amendment to a policing bill, which is still pending, would require men who were prosecuted for being gay to apply for a pardon. It would automatically clear the names of historic figures. Scottish National Party MP John Nicholson, whose stymied private members' bill offered the blanket pardons, warned that under Lord Sharkey's proposal, many men will not open themselves up to the shame and humiliation of applying.
And finally, Tokyo's first-ever Comic-Con has gotten off to a shaky start. The organizing committee first banned what's called male crossplay, men dressing as women, considered by many to be the highlights of any Comic-Con, while not banning female crossplay. Other bans include military and police uniforms and exposure of certain body parts. But following global protest, the committee reversed the crossplay ban this week. However, perhaps the so-called bathroom debate in the U.S. has infected Japan. Tokyo Comic-Con organizers are still requiring crossplay visitors to register and get gender-specific ID cards. They'll need to show them upon request at bathrooms and changing rooms. The committee originally feared what one report called the visual terrorism of middle-aged men dressed in girls' school uniforms.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 29th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. Dad was told by mother, you can't have one without the other.
Belated happy anniversary, Peter and Frank, Ton and Lewis, Helene and Anne-Marie, and Dolphin Geert. We held off for LGBT History Month to honor the 15th anniversary of the world's first legal civil same-gender marriages, which took place in Amsterdam on April 1, 2001. A special parliamentary commission had recommended full marriage equality in 1997, and registered partnerships became available in the Netherlands for both same and opposite gender couples in 1998. In December of 2000, Parliament easily passed the bill opening civil marriage to gays and lesbians, set to go into effect the following April 1st. The International LGBT Community's first wedding day was coincidentally This Way Out's 13th birthday, and just as coincidentally, we'll be distributing our 1,500th program at the end of this year. So it seemed appropriate to end our History Month series by reliving that barrier-shattering event of 15 years ago. The reporter is correspondent Jackie Carver.
It's 11:45 on the 31st of March 2001. We're in the City Council chamber of the City of Amsterdam waiting for the four happy couples to come upstairs. They came in downstairs just about 10 minutes ago, surrounded by press. And here comes Mayor Job Cohen, the Mayor of Amsterdam, who is officiating tonight. The former Minister of Justice, who did so much to push this bill through both houses of Parliament. And here they come. Here comes
Kurt Castile and Dolph Pasca, and followed by Elaine Fasen and Annemarie Toos, Tom Jansen and Louis Rochmans, and finally Peter Wittebroed-Lemke and Frank Wittebroed. And they're taking their seats, and Mayor Cohen is stepping up to the microphone.
Bruidsparen, familie en vrienden.
Brides and bridegrooms, family and friends, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Amsterdam City Council Chamber on this memorable night. We are here to join you in marriage. You are making history tonight. This is the first legal civil marriage between two men or two women, and that is unique in the world. The opening of civil marriage is a milestone in the history of lesbian and gay emancipation. For you, this is a very special moment, probably the happiest day of your lives, and very likely the longest day of your life as well. And it's a double party. You're celebrating that you're getting married, and you're also celebrating that you can get married. Dear couples, last week when we spoke, you told me what marriage means for you. And you were all very definite in your feeling that a registered partnership is a sort of second-rate marriage. Having a registered partnership is a bit like creating a small business. And for all of you, a marriage is something else, something special, that represents the deepest and most emotional bond that two people can have. And very soon, you will be able to say to each other, "We are married." And that does sound better than "we are partners." You all look wonderful, and I wish you the best April the 1st of your lives. I'd like to go over to the formal part of the ceremony, but it's still 2 minutes to 12, so we'll have to wait a bit. Just keep clapping until midnight.
Mag ik u alle acht verzoeken om te gaan staan en elkaar.
Would you all please stand and take each other by the right hand?
Peter Wittebroed-Lemke. Wilt u uw partnerschap met Franciscus Maria Wittebroed omzetten in een huwelijk?
Cohen then asked each couple if they wish to convert their registered partnership into marriage.
Getrouw alle plichten te zullen vervullen die de wet aan de huwelijkse staat verbindt. Peter Wittebroed-Lemke.
By the authority vested in me by the civil register of the city of Amsterdam, I declare you to be married.
Dan verklaar ik.
Mayor Cohen then struck the gavel, and with that hammer blow, history was made. The reception afterwards, we all drank a toast. The first one was to the happy couples, and the second one was to history. I spoke first with Ton Jansen.
You've been together for 36 years. How does it feel to finally get married?
I'm proud, I must say, although that's really unfair because I didn't do it. There are other people who did it, the politicians and so, but it's wonderful to be here and to set this example to the world. That's what I hope it is. All the world is seeing this, the media all together here. Millions and millions of people will look at this and they will see that in the Netherlands it's possible for two men to get the same rights as every other married couple. That's wonderful.
Do you think that this will offer inspiration to other gays and lesbians throughout the world who are struggling?
Most certainly, most certainly. I think Europe will have to follow this.
I then asked Geert Kasteel how he was feeling.
Well, I'm very proud and very happy that I'm married, but it's two parties in one. The first party that I have married my husband, my man, and the second party is that that is able in Holland that we can marry. The civil marriage opened up and it's wonderful.
This is a historic day. Do you hope that this is going to be an example for the rest of the world?
Yes, we hope so, but I think it is a fight of many years.
You look absolutely head over heels in love and happy. Tell me, how was it to stand there and say yes?
Say yes. I thought, well, I want to say yes, but I could not. I just said yes.
Yes.
Nervous, yeah.
Congratulations.
I then spoke with Peter Wittebrood Lemke and Frank Wittebrood.
Tell me why you wanted to get married. What was so important about marriage? I mean, surely that's just a heterosexual institution.
The most important thing is not only the marriage, but the possibility of marriage. And so that is also what we're celebrating tonight. Yes.
And the most important thing is also when you love each other so much like we do and like a lot of people do, then you want to take care of each other. And then you have rights now. So you have rights with heritage, you have rights with pension, you have all the rights like everyone to us with children. You have the rights. And before, it wasn't possible to get that rights. And now it's possible. And you have to choose the choice. You can marry or you cannot marry. Normally it was only for the heterosexuals, and now we can choose like the heterosexual. And I suppose in one generation or two generations, it's quite normal like the right for voting. 100 years ago, it was only the voting rights for men, as you know. And now everyone knows, it's quite normal that everyone, it's ridiculous that only men can vote. And in 15 years or in 20 years, it's ridiculous that only heterosexuals can marry.
Could marry.
Marry. So I hope in a few years they say, it's quite normal. It's
nothing is more normal.
Like the right for voting and all the other rights.
And how did it feel standing there, knowing that you were among the first gay people to get married legally?
Very romantic.
Yes, that's
nothing
nice.
More romantic.
Yeah, that's good. That's the way that we knew before that it was like this, and we have chosen for it because we want to say all the world from you can do it, and it's okay. Holland is the first land, but maybe Sweden or Norway is the second. So, and that's very good.
We hope we are a good example, and many people follow. It's a day we will not easily forget.
Ineke Hauser is the executive director of the COC, the Dutch lesbian, gay, bi and trans rights group. I asked her how she viewed the night's events.
It's an historic day and we all are very proud, of course, with this moment and the result of such a long, long fight for justice.
The COC wasn't actually behind this fight at the very beginning. What changed your mind?
Well, there are two different meanings in the COC. And first, the one who said, well, we have to get rid of the marriage was the strongest. But we more and more realize that it was just a phase in the process, that you have to get equal rights for equal people, and then you can go further on. And that's what we are doing. This is a historic moment, but this is not the end. This is the beginning of the next phase, and that is give way to all kind of other, well, economic and emotional couples. Two people, three people living together, not living together, but have the same rights as couples who want to stay in a close relation together and live together. So we are going on.
And is the CLC planning to spread the knowledge how Holland went about this and achieved marriage? Are they planning programs to help other countries?
Yes, one of the things we do is that we promote in the European Parliament to get our marriage, as we have it now, recognized in their countries. And I think that is really important to start with.
I caught up with Mayor Cohen and asked him how he was feeling.
I'm very glad that it happened. I'm glad that it came through Parliament, and I'm glad that I had the opportunity and that those first marriages took place here in Amsterdam. It's very important that we have this this law here. It's a law for handling it in the same way, and I think that's very important.
And do you think that this is going to set an example for the rest of the world, and that Europe will follow in the footsteps of the Netherlands?
Well, I really hope so. I know by myself that it takes years. I know very well that 10, 15 years ago, when for the first time people said to me, isn't it important that also people of the same sex can marry, I wasn't convinced, not at all. And it took time with me. But now I'm convinced, and I can imagine that also in other countries people can be convinced when they think it over, when they see how important it is that people who want to marry also have the possibility to marry.
And I finally caught up with Henk Krol. He's the editor of the Gay Krant and one of the main proponents of opening up marriage for lesbians and gays, and he was looking just delighted. I asked him if he was feeling as happy as he looked.
Well, I feel incredible. It's unbelievable. And it's the first of April that I'm really happy. 1st of April is my birthday. And I never celebrated my birthday, and now for the first time I have a party on my birthday.
This is the best present ever.
It is, I'm sure. But it's not a present to me, it's a present to the world.
In Amsterdam, this is Jackie Carden.
Since that day in April 2001, marriage equality has become the law of the land in dozens of countries, states, and territories. Among the most recent have been Greenland, Colombia, Finland, and just last week, the British Overseas Territory of Gibraltar. Unfortunately, the wedding ring remains just out of reach in Australia. To hear how civil marriage equality was achieved in the U.S., check out From Outlaws to In-Laws, a CD-only special This Way Out presentation, available at thiswayout.org. You're listening to This Way Out, brought to you by you. Your charitable donations keep this program on the air. We've produced some special CDs to say thank you to our supporters, featuring queer history, LGBT music, and behind-the-scenes looks at relevant movies and TV shows. You can also now get CDs of our regular program by subscription, and be sure you never miss a week of This Way Out. For all the details, please visit our website at thiswayout.org. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Francis O'Brien, Wenzel Jones, Stephen Fry, and Jackie Carver contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Frank Sinatra and Paul McCartney performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, who all make this program possible. Check out the latest show information, special offers, and more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucy Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KGIG Modesto, California, WLUW Chicago, Illinois, Switch 1197 Brisbane, Queensland, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. The U.S. Constitution bans, quote, cruel and unusual punishments, but a majority of states in this nation retain the death penalty. Does that mean capital punishment isn't cruel? And what about claims that the death penalty is administered arbitrarily, that it deters people from committing homicide, that capital defendants don't get adequate legal representation, that it costs more to put people behind bars for life, that racial bias pervades the process by which death sentences are imposed, that the risk that innocent people will be executed means the death penalty must go? Yesterday, I sat down in studio to talk about all of this and more with Matt Cherry, executive director of Death Penalty Focus, a national nonprofit organization based in San Francisco. We also discussed the death penalty measures on next Tuesday's ballot, measures in three states, including California, where voters will decide the fate of Proposition 62 and 66. I began by asking Matt Cherry how long the death penalty has been around in the U.S.
The death penalty has been in the U.S. since the founding of the United States. And we find that the death penalty has been a common punishment around the world throughout history. And it's really only in the last few decades that the world and increasingly the United States has moved against the death penalty.
So tell me about that. What's the trend in terms of states and nations moving away from the death penalty in recent years?
Well, internationally, we have seen a massive movement from where the large majority of the world states had the death penalty as recently as 40, 50 years ago, that now two-thirds of the world's nations have abandoned the death penalty either in law or in practice. And increasingly, it's a very small minority of nations that actually use the death penalty. In fact, the United States is one of the top five execution nations in the world, along with China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Pakistan. So that is the company we keep when we execute. And within the U.S., we've also seen a strong trend against the death penalty. In the last decade, eight states have abolished the death penalty, and another four states have imposed moratoriums on the death penalty.
How many other nations around the world currently have the death penalty, use the death penalty?
Well, there's about 38 nations that still have the death penalty on the books and may use it. But in terms of nations that actually execute people, there are only 9 or 10 countries that regularly execute more than 10 people a year. So I already mentioned five of those countries. The other countries that regularly execute more than 10 people a year include Sudan, Yemen, North Korea, and Iraq. So when you look at the states that actually execute more than a handful of people, other than the U.S., it tends to be very dictatorial, tyrannical regimes that still use this practice. And every other country in the Western world has abandoned the death penalty. Every single country in North America, Central America, South America has stopped using the death penalty. Every single country in Europe, in Western and Eastern Europe, has formally abolished the death penalty. They've all left it behind.
And why is the international context when it comes to the death penalty, why is that so important in your eyes?
Well, I used to work at the United Nations, and I saw the death penalty used by many regimes as a way of enforcing their worst policies, and they use the existence of the death penalty in the U.S. as a justification for some of their worst actions. And whenever we will criticize some of their human rights abuses, for example, countries that would execute people for crimes like blasphemy, they would turn back and say, well, look at the United States. They execute far more people than we do. And I know from my experience at the UN that if the U.S. was to abolish the death penalty, we would very quickly see that the United Nations would outlaw the death penalty. Already, the UN every 2 years has a vote at the General Assembly calling for a global moratorium. And the vast majority of UN members vote for that end to the death penalty. But the U.S. lines up with another 35 or 40 countries who are the worst regimes in the world. They line up with Saudi Arabia and North Korea and those other countries and vote to keep the death penalty. And I think if the U.S. was to switch sides, we would very quickly see that the U.N. would outlaw the death penalty. And that wouldn't mean that, you know, North Korea or Saudi Arabia would immediately get rid of the death penalty. The UN doesn't have that kind of power. But it does mean that those countries would be classified as outlaw regimes because they deliberately kill their own citizens when they do not need to. And that is the definition of the death penalty. It's a deliberate killing of prisoners who no longer pose a threat to the public, where there are other methods of keeping the public safe, and yet the country chooses to kill those people.
Why hasn't the U.S. moved away from the death penalty, given the trends you've been talking about, given the company it keeps, the other nations that still apply and use the death penalty?
Well, the U.S. is moving against the death penalty, and we see a very strong generational shift here. So people under the age of 40 are largely against the death penalty. People under the age of 30 are overwhelmingly against the death penalty. But there is a legacy of very strong support for the death penalty in the U.S. If we go back to the 70s and the 80s, we see the death penalty used as a political tool, as a sort of wedge issue, where people who opposed the death penalty were targeted as being soft on crime, where we saw the case of Michael Dukakis. Many people blame his loss in the presidential election on the Willie Horton adverts that introduced a racial element to the criminal justice debate. And then 4 years later, we saw Bill Clinton go out of his way to show that he was willing to execute African-American prisoners. He actually left the campaign trail to go back to Arkansas and oversee the execution of Ricky Ray Rector, who was sentenced to death but was so brain damaged that he didn't know he was going to be executed. He had his last meal and put aside the dessert and asked if he could have it later because he didn't know what was about to happen. Mm. But Bill Clinton felt that was a good way to show that he was a new kind of Democrat, that he was a Southern governor and was tough on criminals. And I think we saw that big wave in the 80s. Public support for the death penalty was very high up in the 80s. And it's taken a long time to overcome that. But we're seeing a strong trend away. Many individual states are abolishing the death penalty, and public opinion is now strongly moving against the practice.
And how much of this has to do with pragmatic concerns, fiscal concerns, understandings of how much money it takes to present a capital case and all the appeals that are required, and then the housing of people who remain in prison for sometimes decades on death row? And how much do you think has to do with ethical and moral concerns that killing people by the state in this way, in these venues, is wrong?
Yeah, I think the emerging majority against the death penalty is made up of both those components. It's made up of people who oppose the death penalty on ethical grounds, but also people who are coming to realize that the death penalty doesn't work. They may support the death penalty in principle, but they realize it is a failure in practice. And they're surprised to learn that it costs so much more than life in prison without parole. They're surprised to learn it doesn't act as a deterrent. So when we put together those two groups, the people who object to the death penalty on moral grounds and those who object to it on practical grounds, we see a new majority emerging against the death penalty.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you in detail about these arguments about deterrence and this issue of costs. But let's just sketch out a few other basics about the death penalty specifically in the U.S. As I understand it, is it like 30 states in the U.S. that currently allow the death penalty?
Yes, that's
okay.
Right.
And about how many people are executed in the U.S. every year?
Well, it's been going down year on year. So last year, I believe it was 49 executions, which was the lowest in modern history, going back to the 1970s. And this year, it looks like it will be significantly lower than that.
And what proportion of people sentenced to death in the U.S., so on death row, have actually been executed?
I'd have to look back at the figure for the U.S. What I can tell you is in California, more than 1,000 people have been sentenced to die, and only 13 have been executed.
And do we know how many people are currently on death row around the country?
Yeah, currently there's just under 3,000 people on death row across the U.S.
Matt Cherry joins me in studio on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. He is executive director of Death Penalty Focus. That's a San Francisco-based nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment. Can people who were under 18 when they committed the offense punishable by execution, can they be sentenced to die?
Not anymore. The Supreme Court outlawed that about 10 years ago.
And what about people with intellectual disabilities? Can they be executed?
Well, the Supreme Court has been moving against that, and they have said that that should not happen, but the rules are so vague that it does still happen. So they introduced a sort of rule of thumb that anyone with an IQ below 70 should not be executed.
This was the state of Florida, I believe.
Well, this was the U.S. Supreme Court, but the states have been struggling to interpret that because that's a hard and fast rule that doesn't really fit with reality, where sometimes IQ measurements vary, where people have different kinds of disabilities. So the courts are still struggling with how to interpret this rule. And although they have said people with mental disabilities should not be executed, it still takes place, and there's still a danger of that happening. And we find that a large proportion of people sentenced to die still suffer from some form of mental disability or are very close to the age of 18 so that they still have immature brains or they have other mental issues that may not show up but were clearly a factor in the crime in the first place.
Do states and also the federal government, because there are federal capital crimes, do they distinguish between intellectual or mental disabilities and mental illness when it comes to deciding on whether to administer the death penalty?
They try to, yes, but there are all of these issues tend to be mixed up. And there's still evolving case histories on this. And I think the Supreme Court is still struggling to find a way to make this work. And the history of the Supreme Court on this issue is that they have recognized there are problems with the application of the death penalty, and they have tried to clean those up. And again, they run into problems that it's just not that simple to come up with clear rules that will avoid those problems.
And this brings us to one of the elements of an issue generally called arbitrariness, that if the death penalty is administered or assigned in an arbitrary manner, then that's not fair. And given what's at stake, either the system needs to be fixed or we need to get rid of capital punishment. So I think here you're referring to arbitrariness by location, that states or counties may have different likelihoods in terms of how defendants are treated, how they are sentenced, whether they are given the death penalty or maybe given life in prison without parole. So how important is, let's say, the county in which the crime is committed, how important is that to the likelihood of a death sentence?
The location of a crime is incredibly important to how it is treated, how it is punished. And when we look at the arbitrary nature of the death penalty, we see that geography is incredibly important, but it interacts with the other arbitrary nature of the death penalty to do with race and economic status. So we see, for example, that 2% of all the counties in the U.S. account for 50% of the death sentences.
2% of all counties in the U.S. account for 50% of death sentences?
That is correct. And it's overwhelmingly dependent on where the murders are, which jurisdiction those murders take place in. And five of the 15 worst counties are in California. So we see that California is a huge part of the U.S. death penalty system.
Yeah, there's been talk of a new death belt in California, in Southern California. The counties, I believe, are Los Angeles, Orange County, Riverside, San Bernardino, and Kern. Are we talking then about kind of the discretion of the local prosecutor, a willingness maybe of a judge in certain jurisdictions, judges in certain jurisdictions, to dole out the death penalty?
Absolutely. It's very dependent on the prosecutor and also on certain judges in those jurisdictions. And when we look at the politics and the racial makeup of those jurisdictions, we see that there is a lot of political posturing by prosecutors who are trying to get votes by proving they're tough. And we see that there's a lot of racial disparity in those counties. So some of those counties you mentioned, for example, Los Angeles, 98% of death sentences are for people of color. In Orange County, this is from a study Harvard just issued where they looked at 5 years of death sentences. In Orange County, 89% of death sentences were for people of color, and 44% of death sentences in Orange County were for African Americans, even though Orange County only has a population of 2% African American. So we see these incredible racial disparities, which are reinforced by white prosecutors, white judges, white juries. And we see this across the country. People think it's a problem in the Old South, but it's just as much a problem in California and other states that still use the death penalty.
How much does the race of a victim, let's say of a homicide, affect the likelihood of a person being given the death penalty?
It has a huge impact. We do not see many death sentences for black-on-black crime, but we see a lot of death sentences where the victim is white and the accused is black. In fact, across the modern history of the death penalty, there have been 300 African Americans sentenced to die where the victims were white, and only 30 white people sentenced to die where the victim was black.
That's Matt Cherry. He is executive director of Death Penalty Focus. I'm CS, and I'm just going to interrupt the programming for just a few moments to ask you for your support of KPFA's expanded election coverage. We're in the first day of a kind of an understated fund drive to raise money to support KPFA and the election reporting it has been doing and will be doing up and through next Tuesday. And the way to pledge your support is very simple. You go to kpfa.org, and your donations help KPFA survive. It helps KPFA remain independent, stubbornly independent, and able to bring you uncompromised, unfiltered information like the information you're getting from Matt Cherry. And, of course, this is part of election coverage because we are talking about the death penalty, which is on the ballot in California next Tuesday. It's also on the ballot in two other states. And if you stay tuned, you'll also hear about those ballot referenda in Oklahoma and Nebraska. And this costs money to run a station, to keep it going, and also to stay stubbornly independent. Stubbornly independent KPFA. We're going largely thank you gift free this drive because thank you gifts cost KPFA money to buy and a ship, and that comes out of the money you pledge to KPFA. However, if you do go to kpfa.org, there are a few thank you gifts there, KPFA t-shirts, water bottles, a few assorted other things. But really, the thank you gift, if you pledge your support, which I hope you do, by going to kpfa.org is the information, is the material that hopefully informs you and enlightens you and maybe even inspires you and makes you think in different ways and makes you share the information you learn on KPFA and maybe even against the grain with other people via social media, via email, via maybe even conversation, via in-person conversation. Maybe KPFA has helped you or your family or your community stay up to date, and that's what we are really trying to do from November 2nd to November 9th, but of course all the time. But in these 8 days, we are in a kind of understated fund drive to get people to go to kpfa.org and support our special week-long, actually it's week plus long because we're going the day until the day after the election next Tuesday to kind of report on, hey, you know, what happened? What happened on November 8th? What are the implications? What is the impact? KPFA.org is your chance to support KPFA and what we are doing, what we do every day. Let's return now to more of my conversation with Matt Cherry. He's executive director of Death Penalty Focus. Well, you mentioned the issue of deterrence earlier this hour, and this is a big thing, right? Because supporters, proponents of the death penalty will say, well, hey, it deters people from doing heinous things, right? If they know that they might be executed or sentenced to die because of a homicide, for example, they won't do it, or they'll think twice about doing it. So what has been found regarding whether the existence of the death penalty has a deterrence effect, whether it, in fact, deters people from committing, say, homicides?
I actually have some sympathy for the argument for deterrence for the death penalty, because I think it's natural to think that if someone is threatened with death, they will think twice about a crime. But the evidence shows that it doesn't have a deterrent effect. What does have a deterrent effect is the possibility of being caught. And we know that less than 50% of homicides result in a conviction. So that, you know, a lot of people committing murder aren't thinking they're going to be caught. And also the certainty that you will be punished. And we know that the threat of life without parole or other severe punishments are just as effective as the threat of capital punishment, especially since capital punishment is so rare and arbitrary and unlikely to be enforced. So the evidence has shown that there is no strong deterrent effect or any deterrent effect for capital punishment. And there have been a number of studies on this. And recently, the National Academy of Sciences reviewed all of the studies on deterrence and murder and capital punishment and found there was no evidence that capital punishment deters murder.
Yeah, and that report came out in 2012. I read somewhere that police chiefs ranked the death penalty last among effective ways to reduce violent crime. These are police chiefs.
Absolutely. And I think they know not only that the death penalty doesn't deter crime, but the death penalty takes money and resources away from programs and efforts that would actually deter and prevent crime.
What's the relationship between the fact of whether a defendant will receive the death penalty and the quality of legal representation that he or she has been given?
Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Supreme Court justice, said she had never seen a case come before the Supreme Court for capital punishment where the defendant had been well represented. She said, if a defendant has good counsel, is well represented, they will not receive the death penalty.
Wow. And is that assertion of hers, is that backed up by the evidence, by studies?
Absolutely. If we look at people who are on death row, overwhelmingly, they tend to be poorly represented. And we find that the counties and the states that produce most death penalties have the worst defense counsel as well. What we find is a lot of states are very reluctant to adequately fund defense attorneys. So the people who end up taking capital cases tend to be, in many cases, less competent. I mean, I have to be careful in saying this because there are so many fantastic defense attorneys, but the people who actually get convicted and sentenced to die often have very poor representation, and that is because the defense attorneys are not funded, they're not given adequate training, and they don't have a budget in many cases to adequately defend their clients. So they avoid doing research, they avoid getting independent forensic expertise because they can't pay for that.
Yeah, I want to just point out two studies that I came across in preparing for the program. An examination of 461 capital cases by the Dallas Morning News found that nearly one in four condemned inmates has been represented at trial or on appeal by court-appointed attorneys who have been disciplined for professional misconduct at some point in their careers. And in Washington State, a 2001 news report revealed that one-fifth of the 84 people who faced execution in the 20 years prior to that report were represented by lawyers who had been or were later disbarred, suspended, or arrested. Now, this is, you know, information that kind of goes to the extreme, and I hear you about lawyers who are really trying their best but who are overworked and underpaid and under-resourced. So what is the argument that the problems, for example, and let's just stick with legal representation in this case, are so big and so profound that really there is no way to administer the death penalty in a fair, equitable way?
I think that is absolutely the case in practice, because we see that the people who are the strongest supporters of the death penalty, the politicians who are the strongest proponents of the death penalty, are also those who are most reluctant to invest money in an adequate defense. So the people who want to keep the death penalty are the people who refuse to invest the money that would actually make it fair.
Matt Cherry joins me in studio. He's executive director of Death Penalty Focus. That is a national San Francisco-based nonprofit organization that advocates for alternatives to the death penalty. And let's talk in some depth here about money and the question of what saves more money, what saves taxpayers more money. And, you know, so a lot of people think, well, wait a second. So, okay, if someone's going through a capital case, maybe they have more appeals. So on the front end, you know, in terms of court costs and lawyer costs, that's much more than, say, somebody who's eventually sentenced to life without possibility of parole. On the other hand, you know, if they're on death row and then they get executed, well, then, you know, the state doesn't have to worry about all the costs of incarcerating this person for the rest of their life. So on balance, so if you add up everything, how does it, what saves taxpayers more money?
The death penalty is overwhelmingly more expensive than life without parole. So if you want to save the taxpayers' money, replace the death penalty with life in prison. And if we look at California specifically, we see that the death penalty costs about 18 times as much as a sentence of life without parole. And since the death penalty is reintroduced in the late 1970s, California has spent more than $5 billion on a death penalty, and that's $5 billion more than it would have spent if the ultimate punishment had been life in prison.
And is this because so many people on death row just languish there? Like, essentially, they are serving out life sentences without possibility of parole?
That's part of it, yes. A California judge last year said that a sentence of death in California was in reality a sentence of life without parole with a remote possibility of execution. And so what we find is that 98% plus of people sentenced to die in California have not been executed. And out of those people who have been sentenced to die, the vast majority have not completed their appeals process. So all of this money is being spent on appeals attorneys, and the people are just sitting there serving what is, in effect, a sentence of life without parole, but with more attorneys and more privileges and more expenses than someone who is actually sentenced to life in prison.
So there are so many layers of the onion to unpeel here. Another is this issue. It's a controversy around the administration of lethal injection drugs. Tell us about that controversy over, and I think it's whether the use of these drugs constitutes cruel and unusual punishment, which is banned under the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
Right. I think it's worth taking a step back before we look at the specifics of lethal injection and look at an overarching issue here, which is that the U.S. Constitution bans cruel and unusual punishment, as you say, but the death penalty is, by its very nature, cruel and brutal. So we have this intrinsic contradiction between the ban on cruel and unusual punishment and the idea of humane homicide, which is what the death penalty is striving to be. The death penalty inevitably is going to be cruel, and the effort to make it somehow humane always runs into these problems. So we've seen a trend over the last few decades to try to sort of sanitize the death penalty, partly because they're trying to meet legal requirements to avoid cruelty, and also because there's a segment of public opinion who supports the death penalty in the abstract, but is very uncomfortable at the brutal reality of putting someone to death. So we see a lot of contradictions and problems arising out of this. And the attempt to introduce lethal injection as a method of execution makes it look more medical, more, you know, sanitizes the method of killing, but it has created its own problems. First of all, although they try to make it look medical, medical personnel, medical organizations will have nothing to do with the deliberate killing of prisoners. So what ends up happening is that the lethal injection is administered by a prison guard. They pay, you know, $500,000 cash to a prison guard who will volunteer to take part in the execution, but they may not even know the difference between a vein and an artery. They have no training, no skill. We also see that the drug companies object to their medicines, which are designed to heal people, being used to kill people. So the drug companies have refused to sell any of these drugs to prison departments for use in executions. So we're increasingly seeing departments of corrections shopping on black markets, going elsewhere, looking for these drugs. We see them using unskilled personnel. And as a result, the executions are increasingly being botched. We're seeing many horrific cases where the execution, which is meant to be painless, is clearly very painful. The prisoner is struggling, crying out, saying their veins are burning, and in some cases have taken 40 minutes or an hour or more for the prisoner to die.
What's happened to legal arguments that, you know, this situation is untenable from a legal standpoint?
Well, I think we're seeing those arguments occur more and more, but there's been a lot of dissembling and dishonest responses from the states, and increasingly the states who support the use of the death penalty are just trying to hide the whole process from the public. So they're trying to make it secret where they get the drugs from, so there won't be questions about their purity or their provenance or whether they actually work. They're trying to hide the actual execution so that if the execution is botched, there won't be inquiries or bad publicity. So the response has not really been to fix the problem, but to sort of shroud it in secrecy and hope that the public doesn't get too upset.
Do you think there'll ever become a situation in which these drugs are so difficult to get, even on the black market, that states will just say, we need either another method or we just need to abandon the death penalty?
Yeah, I think we're very close to that point right now. Many states that have the death penalty on the books cannot obtain the drugs. And those few states that still have the drugs, it's unclear whether they will have a new supply when current stocks run out or expire. And I think we're very close to the point where it just may be untenable to continue executions using lethal injections.
It's remarkable that we've gone this far without talking about innocence. And, I mean, that's come up in the context of racial prejudice and certain other biases that may mean certain people get the death penalty. But maybe the clearest way into the issue of innocence is exoneration. So how many people on death row have been exonerated and released because of evidence indicating their innocence?
Since the 1970s, we have seen 156 people who were sentenced to die be exonerated because they did not commit the crime.
What does that say to you?
That says to me that the death penalty is inevitably error-prone and that we cannot afford to have an irreversible punishment that has such a high error rate. I actually don't think we can afford to have an irreversible punishment that has any error rate. So even one innocent person is too many. But to see 156 people definitively exonerated from death row shows that the system does not work.
And of course, there may be many other people on death row who are innocent and who just haven't had their evidence gone through in that kind of manner.
Absolutely. We also know of people on death row who died on death row before they can complete their appeals, even though they had very strong claims of innocence. And the standards for appeals is very high. It's much harder to demonstrate your innocence once you've already been convicted than it is to avoid conviction in the first place. So we're looking at very high standards of innocence here. But we see again and again that convictions are shoddy or flawed or biased or error-prone. And very often, the exonerations are not the result of the system working. It's because people on the outside or groups like the Innocence Project have taken up these cases, not the state itself, but outsiders have championed these cases and brought forward new evidence and proven the innocence of these people. It's not a result of the system itself actually working.
I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain. That's Matt Cherry, who I spoke with on tape yesterday for broadcast today. He's executive director of Death Penalty Focus. That is a nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment and also advocates for alternatives to the death penalty. And I'm going to take just a couple more minutes from that interview. We'll go right back to it. Very briefly, but I want to let people know who didn't hear the first time or maybe who need a little more nudging that we are in a kind of a fun drive, but not the kind of fun drive where we hammer you over the head, but where we once in a while interrupt regular programming, regular elections relevant programming to ask you to go to kpfa.org and pledge to support KPFA, to support the election reporting you have been hearing on KPFA, you will be hearing on KPFA. You'll hear, of course, a lot of reporting on the aftermath of the election. And I'm so pleased to bring you the voice of Matt Cherry, who enlightened me on a number of things. I mean, I've been doing political affairs programming for many years now, and you know, I did some research about the death penalty. I thought, well, this is, you know, pretty straightforward. But there's actually so much information coming out and so many developments around the country, including, of course, California, where Proposition 62 and 66 will be voted on next week. And you'll hear Matt Cherry talk about those props in a couple minutes. But I learned so much as I prepared. And I learned even more when I spoke with Matt Cherry, who is really an authority, who keeps track of all these developments, all these studies, all these findings, all these exonerations, and is sharing that information with you via KPFA. KPFA, which is non-commercial, which is non-corporate, and think about how much what we hear about the elections comes from corporate media, comes from ad-filled media, comes from underwriting-filled media. If you like KPFA, if you appreciate KPFA, if you like unfiltered information, uncompromised by corporations or foundations, election coverage, kpfa.org is your way of giving back, giving to us in return to getting, hopefully, something from us every day, or maybe just this hour. Maybe you're just tuning into Against the Grain and you like this kind of in-depth really obsessively in-depth approach that we have here to exploring an issue, to laying out all the various aspects of it, all the various nuances of it, and to really give you as much information as we can so that you can decide. You can decide what you believe, what you think. Please don't believe everything you hear. I know you don't. Please don't believe everything you think. I know you don't. But this is a forum, KPFA and Against the Grain, for giving you information that hopefully you don't hear, well, actually not hopefully, that unfortunately you don't hear in other places. And maybe that has to do with the fact that listeners have been the engine that drive KPFA for more than 60 years. We don't have ads. We don't have underwriting. It's kind of an incredible situation that we are still alive, that we are still here, that you can still hear my voice, that KPFA keeps informing and educating people. It's an incredible thing, and it means that people like you have gone to their phones, in this case, to the website kpfa.org, and given money of their own free will to get free, unfiltered information. kpfa.org is your way to give and to support. And I want to go back now to my interview with Matt Cherry. He is executive director of Death Penalty Focus. Let's talk about the ballot measures that will be voted on next week on November 8th. And there are actually three states that have death penalty-related measures or initiatives or propositions on the ballot. In California, voters will be voting on two measures, Proposition 62 and Proposition 66. What would Proposition 62 do if passed?
Proposition 62 will end the death penalty in California and make the sentence of life without the possibility of parole the ultimate sentence in California. It will also require the people currently on death row to be resentenced to life without parole and require them to work and pay restitution to the murder victim family members. And in addition to that, by abolishing the death penalty in California, it will save California taxpayers $150 million a year.
Opponents of the death penalty tried to get a similar ballot measure passed in 2012 and failed. So why is another attempt being made this year?
In 2012, there was Proposition 34, which was fairly similar to Prop 62. It lost by 48% to 52, so it came very close. And what we have seen in the past 4 years is that the promises made by the death penalty supporters have not come true. No executions have been carried out. None of the problems have been fixed. Death row continues to get bigger and more expensive. And we're also seeing that there is a strong shift in public opinion. People are seeing botched executions and realizing the horror of the death penalty. People are seeing more and more cases of people on death row being found innocent and realize how faulty the death penalty is. And we're also seeing a lot more people just stepping up and speaking out against the death penalty on ethical grounds. For example, we've heard Pope Francis speak to the U.S. Congress last year and tell them that the death penalty is wrong and it should be abolished. And we're seeing more churches, more religious groups, and more secular people just taking an ethical stand against the death penalty, particularly amongst younger Californians. We're seeing a strong majority opposition to the death penalty just in principle.
What about Proposition 66, also on the California ballot next Tuesday? It claims to reform the state's death penalty by streamlining the capital appeals process. So it would speed up the process of executing those on death row?
I think the right word you had here was claims. Because even the supporters of the death penalty in California admit that the system is broken, that it fails to deliver on its promises, that it hasn't executed anyone in 10 years, that it's hugely expensive and doesn't deliver any form of justice. So in order to defend keeping that system, they claim that they're able to fix it. And they also claim that they can fix it without spending more money and without risking executing innocent people. And I think even some of the supporters realize that that is unrealistic. That if you want to have a more effective system of justice, it will take more time and it will cost more money. And to claim that you can have a system that's more effective, costs less, and is faster is just, at best, wishful thinking, and at worst, another false promise to the public that will never be delivered upon. So the proposal they have come up with, Prop 66, is incredibly complex, will add extra layers of appeals, and will also introduce a number of elements that will increase the risk of false convictions and failures on appeals. For example, they will require attorneys who take other appeal cases to start taking capital appeals, death penalty appeals, whether or not they want to. And that means either you have attorneys who are reluctant to take on those cases, or attorneys who simply aren't qualified or experienced to take on those cases, which will make the appeals less effective.
I believe it would also exempt lethal injection cocktails used by the Department of Corrections in California from public oversight.
Right. We talked a little about this earlier, how one response to the problem and the failures of lethal injection is not to fix those problems, but simply to hide them from the public. And so we see this with Prop 66. They're not trying to fix the problems with lethal injections. They're just trying to shroud it in secrecy so that they can get away with botched executions without a public outcry.
And if this Proposition 66 on the California ballot, if it would add layers of appeals, it would also, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, I've read, impose a five-year limit on the appeals process. Doesn't that involve or mandate some kind of expediting of the process?
No, that's actually another false promise. They say it will impose a five-year limit, but there is no system or method for imposing a five-year limit. There is no punishment if the appeals go beyond 5 years, and they're not even willing to fund the attorneys and the expansion of the system that would be required to get all the appeals done in 5 years. So although the proponents are claiming that, it's really another false promise. It doesn't even appear in the ballot label because the Attorney General saw through that false promise. And I think it doesn't take much understanding of the system to realize you could never achieve that without a huge increase in funding.
So that's Prop 66. Prop 62, which would get rid of the death penalty in California. What happens is if both propositions pass, whichever gets the more votes wins. There are a couple of other states that have death penalty ballot referendums that will be decided next week. Nebraska has a referendum that says what?
Nebraska recently got rid of the death penalty, although they have a very conservative public, a very conservative legislature. The legislature voted to abolish the death penalty. The governor then vetoed that, and the legislature actually got a supermajority to overturn the governor's veto. The governor wasn't happy with that. He is very wealthy. His family own TD Ameritrade, which is a very successful business. So they dipped into the family fortune to put the death penalty on the ballot for a referendum this year. And if the governor was to win, then the death penalty would be brought back to Nebraska. It's actually a very complicated referendum because if you want to get rid of the death penalty, you have to vote for retain.
Right.
Because you're retaining the law that just abolished the death penalty. So I don't know how the vote's going to go. I haven't seen much public polling, but I guarantee you there's going to be a lot of confused voters who probably end up voting the wrong way. So I think it's going to be a real mess in Nebraska.
And then in Oklahoma next week, next Tuesday, voters will decide State Question 776. What does that measure provide?
The Oklahoma measure is an attempt to write the death penalty into the state constitution. Oklahoma does have the death penalty and is quite an enthusiastic user of the death penalty, but there have been some problems in recent years with botched executions. So we had a case 2 years ago with Clayton Lockett. The governor of Oklahoma thought it'd be a nice publicity stunt to execute two people on the same day. And even though they didn't have the correct drugs and they didn't have trained personnel, they went ahead with these executions. The first one was horrifically botched. Clayton Lockett spent 43 minutes writhing and fighting against his restraints after he was supposed to be unconscious as part of the execution process. After 43 minutes, they said, okay, it's not working. We'll keep him alive. So they stopped the execution. And having failed to kill him when they were trying to kill him, they then allowed him to die after they decided to keep him alive because he had a massive heart attack. So they called off the second execution, and there's been a lot of public hearings that have shown how badly they botched the execution, how they got the drugs wrong, how they couldn't find a vein. Everything they could do wrong, they did wrong. And I think this initiative is really a response to that. They're aware of the judicial problems. They're aware of changing public opinion. So they want to write the death penalty into the Constitution, and they want to use it to make an end run around judicial oversight and around the constitutional prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. So what the initiative actually says is not only will the death penalty be part of the Constitution, but it states that the death penalty cannot be judged to be cruel and unusual, which I think is really a clear violation of the separation of powers. It's up to judges to decide if something is cruel and unusual, not for the people just to state, irrespective of facts or evidence, that it is by definition not cruel, when clearly the way they have practiced it in Oklahoma has been incredibly cruel and a complete failure of their own goals in executing people.
That's Matt Cherry, Executive Director of Death Penalty Focus, a San Francisco-based nonprofit dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment. I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain. 60 seconds to let you know that if you liked Matt's in-depth analysis, if you liked the issue-by-issue exploration of capital punishment we presented, if you liked the systematic approach to the topic and the issues and all the various facets, many of the various facets of this complex topic, then give a call. No, go online at kpfa.org. Go online at kpfa.org and pledge your support on this first day of an 8-day, very understated fund drive to raise money to support KPFA and the election reporting that it has been doing. And it will continue to do, and will continue to do, in fact, after the election. KPFA.org. Thanks to Erica Bridgman.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.